This is Hunt or Be Hunted, Remaining Embers, by C.H. Bordelon, narrated by Tommy Carrera. Chapter 12. Elliot lies bleeding as he watches the helicopter fade away in the distance. He screams in agonizing pain as he tries to stand up. The bullet wound in his leg is worse than he had anticipated. Not able to stand on his own, he reaches for his cell phone to call for backup, but his phone isn't there. "Damn it!" he shouts, as he remembers the lady in the control booth demanding he leave his gun and any electronics behind before entering the cell block.
"Are you okay? I heard a gunshot,"
one of the guards yells from across the yard.
"I've been shot in the leg."
"Just hold on, I'm on my way,"
the guard replies, as he sprints in Elliot's direction. As the guard approaches, he notices the blood beginning to soak through Elliot's pant leg.
"Can you help me up?"
"I think you should stay put. I will call an ambulance."
"You don't understand. I have to stop him. I need my phone,"
Elliot replies as he tries to stand on his own again. When his legs fail him this time, the guard catches him.
"Thank you,"
Elliot says as he throws his arm over the guard's shoulders.
"It's all right, I got you."
"I'll just lie back down and wait for help. What's your name?"
Elliot asks.
"Ivan."
"Do you have a family, Ivan?"
"Yeah, a wife and two kids, a boy and a girl."
"Then let me ask you this. Would you let a bullet in your leg stop you from protecting them?"
The guard's face lights up, as if a ball were turned on above his head.
"No, I wouldn't."
"Then please, don't let me do the same thing. I just need you to get me to my phone."
"Come on then, let's get you to your phone."
They're in complete shock when they finally reach the control booth. They find the body of two guards with blood pouring from their necks. The doors leading to the control booth are wide open, and the girl is gone. The door can only be buzzed open from the inside, which leads Elliot to believe the rioting prisoners must have used two guards as collateral to open the door. Ivan props Elliot against the ice-cold cinder block wall and searches the booth for Elliot's phone. He returns with a pile of smashed-up cell phones.
"What the hell is that?"
Elliot asks.
"I'm guessing it's all that's left of the cell phones."
"Jesus Christ, now what are we going to do?"
Elliot rambles.
"There's a phone in the warden's office right down the hall. Can you make it?"
"I don't. You go. But call this number and ask for Larry Gray. Tell him what happened here. And that Special Agent Roberts is down."
"All right."
"Wait,"
Elliot says, through deep, heavy breaths.
"What is it?"
"Tell him that Jones has escaped, and he's on his way to road..."
Elliot has lost too much blood and passes out. As Elliot begins to regain consciousness, he quickly realizes the hallway is now dark. He looks in the direction he last saw Ivan heading in. There appears to be a dim light hanging from the ceiling 20 feet away. Elliot is trained to keep focus under pressure, but the fact that he's unarmed and in an unsecure prison makes even one of the FBI's best a little nervous. The prisoners must have shut the power off.
"It's a damn good thing they have a backup generator,"
Elliot thinks to himself. There are dim backup lights every 50 feet along the hallway. These are the emergency lights that only turn on when the backup generator is activated. Still injured, he slowly slips down the hallway towards the warden's office. He uses the wall to lean against, as he drags his injured leg behind him. It's an extremely painful and slow process, but a man has to do what a man has to do. Right now, Elliot has to find Ivan. As Elliot slowly creeps down the dark, narrow hallway, he is approaching a T.
"Now what do I do? Should I go left or right?"
Elliot thinks. He suddenly hears footsteps and shouting from around the corner. The sounds are getting closer. Unarmed and injured, Elliot has no chance, so he does the only thing he can think of and plays possum. He lies face down in the dark shadows. Elliot's pulse begins to race as he now hears the men standing above him.
"Please, just keep going,"
Elliot thinks to himself.
"We gotta find a way out of here,"
one of them says with a deep southern drawl.
"Why should we leave? Hell, we got everything we want right here."
"Yeah, Rock D is right. We should just stay and take over the prison,"
Elliot hears a third man say.
"No offense, Rock. I know you're pretty tough and all, but when reinforcements come, they will take this prison back over. I, for one, would much rather be on the beach in Miami when that happens,"
the southern man replies.
"All right, Casey. Miami does sound pretty good,"
Rock D replies.
"Woohoo! What do we have here?"
The third man shouts as he lets out a creepy giggle.
"Looks like another dead pig to me,"
Rock D says.
"Check him for a key card,"
Casey replies. As the man searches his pockets, Elliot tries to remain calm and motionless.
"He doesn't have anything. As far as I can tell from the dark, he doesn't look like a guard.
Turn him over and see if he's still breathing,"
Rock D demands. Elliot's on the verge of panic. If they find out he is still breathing, they will probably finish him off. And Elliot doesn't want to die. Not like this. Not here. Not today. At this moment, Rock D hears something.
Wait. Don't move. Be quiet. There's somebody down there.
He whispers as he points down the hallway.
Leave the pig. Let's go find out what's down there.
Rock D says. The three men leave Elliot where he lies and sprint down the hallway. Elliot continues lying motionless until he can no longer hear the sound of their footsteps running down the hallway.
Damn, that was close,
he thinks to himself as he lets out a sigh of relief. After the close call, Elliot decides it's time to try and find a weapon. Even a jailhouse shank would be better than nothing in his current condition. After venturing down the hall a little further, he comes to cell block B. The cell block door is wide open, which Elliot knows is a good sign. This means that most of the prisoners that are locked inside the cell block are probably roaming the halls. The ones that are still inside are free to come and go as they please. Elliot inches his way to the door and quietly takes a peek inside. He sees about 50 inmates congregating in the middle of the cell block.
Guess I won't be finding my shank in there, he thinks.
Suddenly, one of the inmates spots him peeking around the corner.
Hey, who the fuck are you?
The man shouts. Elliot quickly ducks back into the hall. From there, he can hear the men talking.
You're crazy.
I'm telling you, there was somebody in the hall and he didn't look like one of us.
But check it out.
Elliot hears one of the men say and figures this guy must be their leader.
Here, kitty, kitty, kitty. Ready or not, here we come.
One of the men shout, while the others just shout random profanity. Elliot is physically unable to run or fight them off, so he does the next best thing and reaches for the door. Just as Elliot tries to slam it shut, one of the men manages to stick his arm between the door and the frame. Elliot could hear the man's bones crack.
Shit! He broke my arm!
The man screams in excruciating pain. There are three other men standing behind the one with the arm stuck in the door.
Don't just stand there. Get the fucking door open!
One of them shouts. They begin pushing on the door from the inside. Elliot tries to wedge his foot beneath the door and plant his shoulder into it for leverage. There are three men pushing against the door, while one injured special FBI agent tries to stop them from opening it.
Open the door! We're the good guys! We won't hurt you!
The man with the broken arm shouts. But Elliot just pushes harder, and the man's agonizing screams get louder. It doesn't take long for reinforcements to arrive. There is now a large crowd of prisoners surrounding the door from the inside. With the fact that he's not 100%, and there's now at least 10 men pushing against the door, Elliot loses the battle. The door flies open, and Elliot is thrown to the floor. The man with the broken arm instantly drops to his knees and cradles his arm as if it were a newborn baby. Five of the men attend to their fellow inmate, while the rest of them crowd around Elliot. Elliot glances around. There's no room for escape, even if he were physically fit.
This is it. This is where I die,
is the only thought that crosses Elliot's mind. For what seems to be an eternity, the men just crowd around him, making a barrier in complete silence. Elliot's eyes are wide open. His heart is racing 100 miles an hour. He's beginning to break out in a cold sweat, and his skin now feels clammy.
You look scared. Scared to death, actually,
one of the men finally says.
Is that even possible, other than your fear causing you to have a heart attack?
Elliot thinks to himself, but doesn't say a word. He can tell by the man's voice he was the one that Elliot figured to be their leader.
Looks like you broke Slim's arm,
the man says.
He damn sure did. I know the pain of broken bones when I feel it,
Slim shouts from behind the crowd.
Why did you have to go and break his arm? Now I'm forced to make a decision on what to do with you.
Elliot still doesn't break his silence.
It would be wise for you to talk to me.
Elliot shrugs his shoulders in response.
What's your name?
The man asks.
Elliot.
Elliot, my name is John. The locals call me Bones. So what are you doing here, Elliot? Because I know for damn sure you're not an inmate. And you also don't look like one of the guards.
I guess I'm going to die anyway. So I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts with the FBI.
Hey, I know you. You're the one that captured the Saw Killer,
one of the men in the crowd says.
That's right. I got a letter from Jones, so I came here to prevent the escape.
Doesn't look like that worked out so well for you, Bones interrupts.
I've been shot in the leg. I'm tired, and I'm sure Jones is getting close to my wife and son by now. So I would rather you just kill me now and get it over with,
Elliot pleads.
Kill you? You do know there are some innocent people in prison, right? Well, not all of us are actually innocent, but we have changed our ways. Either way it goes, we're not going to kill you, Elliot. Now let's get your leg checked out. Thanks, but I really need to get to a phone. Can you help me?
The only one I know of is in the warden's office,
Bones replies.
Will you take me there?
After looking around at his faithful followers, Bones lets out a deep sigh and says,
Yeah, we can do that. But I have to warn you, the prison is extremely unsafe.
Aren't prisons always that way? Yeah, but there's some kind of order. Right now, the inmates are free to roam the halls. Well, the ones that haven't left already anyway. Do you have weapons? Elliot asks.
We have a few, but with a group this large, we shouldn't run into any problems.
Unless they find out you're a cop,
one of the other men adds.
He has a good point. Maybe we should get you changed into something more casual, Bones says, as he motions one of the men with his head.
The man returns shortly with a prison jumpsuit, and Elliot gets changed into it. Bones and his gang of inmates escort Elliot down the dark, deserted hallways of the prison. Although Elliot doesn't feel completely comfortable with the fact that he now has a bunch of prisoners watching his back, he is grateful that he isn't alone. With him now wearing the oversized prison-issued jumpsuit, at least he can blend in and not stick out like a sore thumb.
How much further is the office? Elliot asks.
Just down the hall and around the corner. We're almost there, Bones replies.
At this moment, five inmates come running down the hall from the opposite direction.
Better get out while you can,
one of the men shouts.
Why? What's up? Bones replies.
We just heard over the radio the FBI is sending in the cavalry,
a tall, skinny black man replies, as the five men sprint down the hall.
Yeah, I'm out of here. I'm not waiting for the FBI to show up. You know those bastards shoot first and ask questions later,
one of the men in Bones' group says.
Yeah, let's get out of here,
another replies. Before it's all said and done, 10 of Bones' group have left and made a break for the exit. At an earlier glance, Elliot estimated 50 men in the group. The actual number was 33, so with 10 gone, only 23 remain. Elliot would much rather be with 23 other men while injured than alone roaming these dangerous halls. When they reach the warden's office, the door is wide open. Elliot immediately sees Ivan lying in a pool of blood.
Shit,
Elliot says.
Did you know him?
Bones asks.
Not really, but he helped me when all of this first started.
The phone should be right over there on the desk,
Bones says as he points towards the desk. Elliot picks up the phone, but there's no dial tone.
I don't think you're going to be using that phone to make a call,
one of the men in the group says as he holds the other end of the phone cord in the air.
They cut the line,
Elliot shouts as he slams his fist into the desk.
I was afraid this might happen.
Sure, they didn't want anyone calling out for help,
Bones says.
Can you get me out of this prison?
I don't want to be outside when the FBI shows up. I don't have much of a life, but it's mine and I like it.
Please, look, I understand that. Just take me to the exit, that's it.
I won't get that close, and I won't ask any of these guys to do it either.
He's going to kill my wife and son if I can't warn them. Please, I'm begging you, just take me to the exit.
I'll take you, even though you did break my arm. But I have a wife and son out there as well. Lord knows, I wouldn't want anything to happen to them,
Slim says.
Thank you.
Come on, follow me, Elliot.
Slim and five of the other men head for one of the exits. As they approach one of the exit doors, Elliot notices the doors being propped open by one of those guards' lifeless bodies. In the distance, they can hear sirens.
They're coming! We gotta get out of here, man!
One of the men shouts as he runs out of the door, and four of the other men quickly follow. Now Elliot and Slim are the only two left standing in the doorway.
Get on the ground now! Stop running or we will shoot!
Three of them instantly get on the ground. The other two's eyes see daylight and freedom, so they sprint towards the woods like a runner that sees the finish line in front of him. Without further warning, the FBI agents, armed with automatic weapons, quickly dispose of the fleeing inmates.
This is Special Agent Elliot Roberts. Don't shoot! I'm coming out!
As Elliot exits the door, he's greeted by the perils of the FBI SWAT team aimed down at him.
Get on the ground!
One of the men shouts.
Call it in on the radio. Tell them you have Elliot Roberts.
I said get on the ground now!
The cocky rookie agent demands again.
It's extremely important that you get on the radio and tell them that Harry Jones, a.k.a. the Saw Killer, has escaped, and he's going after my family as we speak.
This is your last warning. If you don't comply, you will be shot.
Roberts? Is that you?
A man from behind the SWAT team says.
Lower your weapons. He's one of us, you idiots.
Roberts, you look like shit. I'm fine. Call ahead and tell him to get the jet ready. I need to go to Rhode Island immediately.
You need to see a...
I need to go to Rhode Island. That's all I need. He's after my family. Why won't you listen to me?
Elliot interrupts.
All right, I'll make the call, but in the meantime, let the medics check you out.
Elliot just simply replies.
All right.
Chapter 13. After briefly getting checked by the medic and refusing immediate medical attention, Elliot is on the plane headed for Rhode Island. He has made several attempts to call his wife and son, but neither one have been answering their cell phones. After a 45-minute flight, the plane lands at a small private airport in Rhode Island. Once again, the FBI has a car waiting for Elliot, but this time, he has a driver and backup all in one. Elliot would normally be offended by this, but he knows the man. Jerry Bell is a fellow FBI agent that Elliot has worked a case or two with once before.
How you holding up, Elliot?
I'm alive. I guess that counts for something. I need to get to my wife's sister's house immediately.
I heard about the situation with Jones' escape. I contacted the local authorities and had them send a unit to the house to keep an eye on things, says Bell.
I appreciate that,
Elliot replies.
Anytime, man.
When they arrive at the house, they see the unit parked across the street. Elliot walks over to talk to the officer.
I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts with the FBI. I would like to personally thank you for looking after my family.
Not a problem. We all have to stick together.
Has anyone been here?
Not since I've been here, and I've been here about an hour and a half.
Have you seen any suspicious vehicles or anything else that might stand out?
Elliot asks.
Haven't seen a thing, sir.
Well, thanks again, but we can take it from here.
10-4.
Elliot is nervous as he walks to the house. He's not sure what to expect. If everything's okay, why aren't they answering their phones? Elliot knocks on the front door. No answer. He rings the doorbell. Again, no answer. Elliot tries the doorknob, but it's locked.
Let's go around back and see if we can get in,
Elliot suggests.
All right, I've got your back.
The two men walk down a narrow stone pathway leading to the backyard. As they approach closer, they can hear the sound of music playing from a stereo. Elliot opens the gate. A part of him expects to see Jones standing on the other side, but all he sees is his wife and sister standing by the grill.
Oh my God, baby, what happened to you?
She immediately says when she sees her husband.
Nothing. I'm all right. Where's Junior? Is he okay?
Elliot replies.
He's fine. He's in the pool swimming. What's going on, Elliot? What happened to you?
She demands.
Jones escaped from prison. He left me a note saying he was coming after you and our son, and when I tried to pursue him, he shot me in the leg.
Oh my God, Elliot! You've been shot!
Sharon shouts.
Let's get you to the hospital now.
I will be.
Shut it, Elliot! You're going to the hospital!
Sharon interrupts. Elliot is admitted to the hospital where he receives several pints of blood. The doctors in the ER decide to keep Elliot overnight for observation. Although Elliot strongly disagrees, between the doctors, his superior officers, and his wife, he really doesn't have a choice in the matter.
Elliot, I'm going back to the house to let Junior know that everything's okay with you.
Okay, baby. I'm so glad you're okay.
Elliot replies as he rubs his hands across her cheek.
I'll be back in the morning to pick you up.
I love you, Sharon.
I know you do. I love you too,
she replies as she bends down and kisses him on the lips. Later that night, Elliot is restless and can't sleep, so he turns on the television.
It's complete mayhem in Minnesota today. Residents everywhere are either leaving the state or barricading themselves in their homes. Earlier this afternoon, a massive prison riot broke out at Maple Heights. Some of the worst prisoners in the country were once held in this facility. But now hundreds, if not thousands, of those prisoners are roaming the streets of Minnesota. The most notorious of these prisoners would be none other than Harry Jones, a.k.a. the Saw Killer. 10 years to the day, Jones was arrested by FBI agent Elliot Roberts after going on a killing spree in Greenland, Minnesota. I personally reached out to Agent Roberts and requested an interview, but he refused to answer any of my questions regarding Harry Jones.
Lying sack of shit,
Elliot says as he turns the television off.
Why do those damn reporters always have to lie?
Elliot thinks to himself. An hour later, Elliot finally falls asleep. Ring, ring, ring. Elliot is awakened by the sound of the hospital phone, which is on the nightstand next to his bed.
Hello?
Elliot answers, still half asleep.
Hello, my good friend Elliot. My, oh my, how I've missed our little conversations.
Jones?
Oh, great. You do remember me.
Where the hell are you?
I'm a lot closer than you think, Elliot. Let's just say that I know that the hospital is exactly 1.2 miles from your sister-in-law's house. Oh, and the stone pathway leading to the backyard? Absolutely gorgeous.
Jones, you leave my family out of this. This is between you and me.
That's where you're wrong, Elliot. A psychopathic serial killer such as myself will kill anyone to satisfy their own needs. And I have to warn you, my urges are extremely strong right now. The only problem I have at this point is figuring out who to kill. Any suggestions?
Jones, I'm begging you. Leave my family alone. Take me instead.
Oh, Elliot, that wouldn't be any fun. I could have killed you plenty of times if I wanted you dead.
Elliot drops the phone, rips the IV out, and jumps out of bed. Wearing nothing but a hospital gown, he races down the halls towards the elevator. As he sprints past the nurse's station, one of them shouts,
You're not supposed to be out of your room. I'm calling security.
When the elevator stops on the ground floor, the doors slowly open. Elliot is greeted by two security officers.
Sir, we're going to have to escort you back to your room now.
Elliot delivers a sharp kick to the knee, followed by a powerful right uppercut to the bottom jaw.
He quickly spins around the guard as he falls to the floor.
Stop where you are!
The other guard shouts as he reaches for his stun gun. With cat-like reflexes, Elliot delivers a devastating haymaker to the side of the guard's head. The man is out cold before he even knows what hit him. Elliot sprints for the exit. He now looks like an escaped mental patient, wearing a hospital gown, sprinting down the main highway in town. Elliot doesn't know if it's just his adrenaline or if his leg is healed, but either way, he's never run this fast in his life. It takes him a total of 6 minutes to make the 1.2-mile sprint. The house is pitch black when he arrives. Elliot can hear his wife screaming for help and begging for her life. When he reaches the doorknob, he notices it's glowing red hot. He grabs it anyway and feels the skin melting off his hand, but the door won't open.
Jones, please don't hurt her. I'm here. Take me instead,
he shouts.
Elliot! Elliot, is that you? Help me, Elliot!
Sharon says.
Jones, open the door!
Elliot demands.
Elliot! Elliot!
Sharon screams his name again.
Elliot! Elliot, wake up!
When Elliot opens his eyes, he sees Jerry and notices that he's still in the hospital.
Thank God, it was just a dream,
Elliot says.
You need to get dressed and come with me.
What's going on, Jerry?
Just get dressed.
Did something happen last night?
Yes.
Now get dressed, Elliot. Tell me, Jerry, what happened to my family?
Elliot, you know I can't tell you anything. You just need to come with me.
Look at me, Jerry. If it were your family, wouldn't you want to know?
Your wife and son are missing.
How the hell did this happen, Jerry?
We had a guy posted outside the house, but we found him still sitting in his car this morning with his throat cut.
What about my wife's sister? Is she missing as well?
No. Jerry takes a deep breath and continues. The son of a bitch raped her and strangled her in her own bed with a piece of military-grade tripwire.
Jesus Christ! It was Jones. He has my family.
Slow down. What makes you so sure it's Jones?
Well, other than the fact that he left me a note in his prison cell all but telling me he was going after my family, that's the way he tried to kill Jennifer Cole, and there was a young rookie street cop posted outside of her house.
Let me guess. He slit his throat?
Jerry replies.
That's exactly what he did. He's taunting me,
Elliot replies. Now at the scene, his sister-in-law's house. It's exactly the way Jones did it last time. He even left the knife stuck in the counter. But this time it seems that Jones learned from his mistake with Jennifer Cole.
What the hell are you doing here?
Elliot's senior agent says.
I brought him, sir, Jerry replies.
Roberts, I need you to exit the scene immediately.
Sir, I can't do that.
You damn well better. This isn't a request, Roberts. It's an order.
You can't ask me to stand around and twiddle my thumbs and do nothing while that maniac has my wife and son,
Elliot replies as he slightly raises his voice in anger.
Look, Roberts, I understand your situation, but the doctor has to clear you for work before you can even think about getting on the case.
I'm fine,
Elliot begins to reply before he is interrupted by his senior agent.
It's not a debate, Roberts. Head down to the local agency and I'll meet you there in a couple of hours.
Elliot doesn't say another word. He just turns and walks out. A few moments later, Jerry comes running out of the house.
Elliot, wait. They found something.
Elliot stops and turns around as he says,
What is it?
I don't know, but they're asking for you.
As Elliot re-enters the house, one of the other agents hands him a letter.
It's addressed to you. Where was it found?
Elliot asks.
Hanging on the back of the victim's door.
The letter reads,
My dear friend, I am truly sorry for shooting you. However, I couldn't let you ruin my plan. But, considering the fact that you're now reading this letter, it must mean that you have survived your wound. Like I stated once before, you are one tough cookie to crack. All formalities aside, now let's get to the point of my letter. I'm sure the scene looks eerily familiar to you. That's because I carefully planned it that way. I wanted to leave no doubt in your mind that I am the one that now has your wife and son. The outcome of the situation is entirely up to you, Elliot. Due to the fact that you worked out my last riddle with no problem at all, I've decided to make this one quite a bit more challenging. I'm going to give you a phrase in a very sparsely used language. You will have 3 days to figure it out. If or when you figure it out, you must come alone. If I even so much as sense the presence of anyone else, your family, starting with your wife, will be shot on sight. I do hope to see you soon, Elliot. Oh, and one last thing. I hope you don't try to cut any corners by going to any language specialist. I do have a close friend of mine keeping an eye on you. He's very good with technology, so you will never know he's watching or listening to your every move or words. The only way this will work is if you figure it out on your own. I will give you a clue. Although the language is very scarce, it is used in 2 different countries. Sure familia ejiza dulhatus. Nire ama no jakingo. Signed, AK. Has anyone seen this? Elliot asked the agent.
No, I found it and wanted to give it directly to you.
Thank you. Listen to me. This is very important to the safety of my family. I need you to say that you read the letter and that it was just a personal note for my wife. Do you understand? Elliot says. With a wide, bug-eyed look, the agent agrees. Thank you, Elliot says, as he sticks the letter in his pocket and exits the house once again. Elliot goes to the local library to see if he can find anything out about the mysterious language. He knows from his Spanish class in high school that familia is Spanish for family, so he starts his search with the Spanish language. Elliot finds a Spanish-to-English dictionary and begins to look for some of the other phrases in the note. Much to Elliot's surprise, none of the other words are matching up.
Damn it! Why does Jones always have to play these stupid little games?
Elliot says to himself. All right, calm down. Just slow down and think about it, Elliot mumbles to himself. Elliot then makes his way over to the computers. After impatiently waiting for about 30 minutes, one of the three computers is finally open. Elliot types the phrase, rarely used languages, in the Google search bar, one slow finger tap at a time. Among the results that pop up is top 10 languages you probably never heard of.
Okay, this looks like a good start,
Elliot thinks as he clicks on the link. The first language on the list is Basque, a language still spoken today by over 600,000 people. What makes this language so rare is that it is only spoken in two small areas of the world, on the border of France and Spain.
It's spoken in two different countries. That has to be it,
Elliot says to himself. He then searches the library for a book on the Basque language. The search for a book comes up empty. Elliot goes back to the computer, where he searches Google to figure out how to translate the language. Another slow tap of his finger at a time, Elliot types in how to translate the Basque language. After searching through numerous translation books for sale online, Elliot comes across a link that says Google Translate. After clicking on the link, he is amazed to see how easily this program works. All he has to do is choose a language that he wants translated and the language he wants it translated into. After choosing the Basque language and having it translated to English, Elliot types the unknown phrase into Google Translate. Now all he has to do is click the translate button. The phrase Elliot enters is a perfect match for the Basque language. He now has found and translated the language. The Basque phrase translates to, quote, I am taking your family hunting. My mother will know where, end quote. Although he is excited that he's figured out the mystery, he can't help but wonder why it was so easy. Did Jones want him to find it this easy? Maybe Jones underestimated Elliot's intelligence. Or maybe, just maybe, Elliot caught a break and Jones doesn't know anything about Google Translate. Whatever the circumstances may be, Elliot has the information he needs and is now on his way back to Minnesota. Chapter 14. Mid-afternoon the next day, Elliot arrives in Greenland, Minnesota, a town he thought he would never see again.
This place hasn't changed a bit,
Elliot thinks to himself as he drives through town on his way to Green Lake. Even though it's been many years since Elliot has been to Green Lake, Minnesota, it's not hard for him to find the gas station where he first met Joan's mother. In fact, it's a straight shot from Greenland, but little did he know he was in store for a big surprise. Elliot arrives at the gas station to find that it has been abandoned and looks like it has been that way for years.
Shit,
Elliot shouts as his emotions begin to get the better of him. Seasoned FBI agent or not, the man's family is at stake here, and he knows he doesn't have time for games. But since it first started, Jones has always been one step ahead of him. Elliot now knows that if he wants to gain the advantage, he has to think outside of the box.
I need to figure out what Jones would expect me to do and do the opposite,
Elliot thinks to himself.
All right, my first instinct as an agent would be to go into town and see if anyone knows where to find Mrs. Knox. Therefore, I need to go back to Greenland and see if Tom Clover is still around. Yeah, that should get me off Jones' plan,
Elliot thinks to himself. Elliot arrives in Greenland at the police department. As he walks up the steps leading to the front door, he can't help but remember the bullet exploding out of Chief Galloway's head. The gruesome memory sends a chill down Elliot's spine. After all, he was just standing a mere 2 feet away from the chief when it happened. It could have just as easily been him that day. As Elliot enters the lobby, he sees a familiar face. The young girl working the counter the night it all happened. That night that Jones came for Tom Clover. The girl, now a woman whose age and stress are beginning to show, instantly recognizes Elliot.
Oh my heavens! Agent Roberts, how have you been?
She says.
I've been good. Can I get you to do me a favor?
Elliot asks.
Sure thing. Anything for you, Agent Roberts.
I need you to find out if Tom Clover is still in town.
As she begins to reply, Elliot hears a man's voice coming from behind him.
I'm still in town, Agent Roberts,
the man says. Elliot turns around to see if it is indeed Tom Clover.
Agent Roberts?
Tom. The two men exchange greetings as they nod their heads at one another.
What brings you back to Greenland?
Tom asks.
I have a situation. Is there somewhere where we can go talk privately?
Sure. My office is right down the hall.
Tom replies as he leads the way. As they enter Tom's office, Elliot notices the sign on the door. Tom Clover, janitor.
Come on in. Have a seat.
Tom says as he clears a box of rags from the chair across from his desk. Elliot sits on the chair, as does Tom on the other side of the desk. Tom begins the conversation with an icebreaker.
So, Elliot, how have things been going for you?
Tom, I don't mean to be rude, but I'm not here on a social call. I need your help.
My help? What can I do for you?
I can't get into details, but I need to know where I can find Miss Knox.
That psychopath's mother? Why do you need to find her?
Tom replies, with a look of disbelief all over his face.
I told you, Tom, I can't get into details. I'm sorry, but I can't. Can you help me?
Yeah, I know exactly where she is. Come on, I'll show you.
I just need the directions, please. Tom, I can't get you involved in this any more than I already have.
I understand, Agent Roberts, but it's a lot easier to just take you than to tell you how to get there. How about I just show you where she is, then I'll go and leave you to your business. Deal?
Tom suggests, as he tilts his head and shrugs his shoulders. After a long 3-second pause, Agent Roberts lets out a deep breath and agrees to the deal. Agent Roberts follows Tom for approximately 10 miles, and then Tom makes a right turn off the main road onto a gravel road. They continue down the gravel road for another 2 miles, where they then come to a stop. Both men exit their vehicles, and then Elliot walks over to Tom.
What is this?
Elliot asks.
It's the only cemetery around for miles. Greenland and all the neighboring towns use it.
Are you telling me that Mrs. Knox is dead?
Yes, she passed away 4 years ago. Do you want me to take you to her gravesite?
Yeah, but first tell me how you know where it is.
Elliot replies.
I went to her funeral and I come to her gravesite every year.
Tom replies as he breaks eye contact and looks away.
Why?
Asks Elliot.
Because I've never been able to understand how such a sweet woman could give birth to such a monster like Jones.
It's not like you're going to get any answers from her. So why do you keep coming?
Because it's not her fault, and I think sometimes she felt like it was. So I come here to let her know that I never blamed her.
I understand,
Elliot replies. Tom then leads Elliot to Mrs. Knox's gravesite.
Here it is,
Tom says, as he points to a tombstone.
Thank you, Tom.
Tom nods his head and says,
if you need anything else, you can find me in Mrs. Green's farm. She passed away 7 years ago and left the farm to me in her will. I'm sorry to hear that.
Tom nods his head in agreement and then walks away. A few moments later, Elliot shouts,
Tom, come back over here.
What is it, Agent Roberts?
Look,
Elliot says as he points at the dirt.
What am I looking at?
Tom asks.
You said she passed away 4 years ago. Then why does the dirt look freshly disturbed?
Replies Elliot.
I don't know. It wasn't like that last time I was here.
We're going to need a shovel, Tom.
Hey now, Agent Roberts, I don't mind helping you, but if you want me to go digging up old ladies' graves, then I need to know some of those details. What exactly is going on here?
Tom replies with a stern tone to his voice.
That's fair enough. Jones escaped from prison and kidnapped my wife and son. He left me a note leading me to his mother. It said that she would know where to find him.
I'm so sorry, Agent Roberts. I'll be right back. I think I have a shovel in my car.
Shortly after, Tom returns with a small spade. The two men take turns digging until they reach Mrs. Knox's coffin. Elliot then uses the spade to pry open the casket. Elliot finds a folded piece of paper placed in what's left of Mrs. Knox's hands. Elliot takes the paper from her hands and unfolds it, just as he had thought. It's a note. The note reads,
Hello, Elliot. I see that you have found my mother. It's a shame that I wasn't able to make it to her funeral. That poor woman always did see the best in me, although it is your fault that I was in prison. I don't entirely blame you for that fact. I've accepted some of the blame as my own. I should have never let you catch me in the first place. But don't worry. That's a mistake I plan to never make again. Now, let's get to the point here. I have something you want, and you have something that I want. I can imagine that you're wondering what exactly it is that you have that I so desperately want. The answer is simple. In fact, he's probably standing right beside you. That's right. I want Tom Clover. Now, I guess you're wondering how I knew that Tom would be there. Am I right, Elliot? It really was just a simple process of elimination. I knew you would go to the store looking for my mother. I also knew that she wouldn't be there and that you would have to crawl back to town looking for help. Well, I knew you wouldn't go to either Big John or Little John after what we put them through during the investigation. And I've killed everyone else, so that pretty much left Tom. All right, so now, here's what you do. Ask Tom if he's ever heard of Hunter's Bluff. He will know exactly where it is and offer to take you there. The law enforcement instinct inside of you will naturally kick in and you'll probably tell him not to come along. But Elliot, that would be a huge mistake. I will be at Hunter's Bluff tomorrow at exactly 12 p.m. And if you come alone, then you will have to make another tough decision. However, if you bring Tom Clover to me, he will be killed, but you will have your family back. The choice is yours. Elliot, I suggest you choose wisely. Signed, A.K.
What does the letter say?
Asked Tom.
It says, I need to find a place called Hunter's Bluff. Have you heard of it?
Yeah. It used to be the most popular hunting spot in the state, but over the years, the animal population has decreased there.
Do you know where it is?
Yeah, it's not very far from here. I can show you where it is.
All right. Well, let's get some rest tonight. Jones says that I need to be there at 12 p.m.
Elliot replies.
We should be ready to go and meet at the station at 9 a.m.,
Tom suggests.
Sounds good, Tom. I'll see you then.
The next morning, Tom and Elliot meet at the police station at 9 a.m., exactly as they had discussed the night before.
You can just ride with me,
Tom says.
Thanks, Tom, but I plan to get my family back today, and we will need some time alone.
I completely understand.
Well, if you're ready, you can follow me then.
The men get into their vehicles and leave the station, headed towards Hunter's Bluff. Tom and Elliot arrive at an overlook, which looks to be what is left of an abandoned rest area. Tom exits the vehicle and walks towards Elliot.
Is this it?
Elliot asks as he exits the vehicle.
What's left of it anyway? This used to be the most popular gathering point for hunters all over the nation, but as you can tell, it hasn't been used in years. The animal population drastically fell in this area, so the people just stopped coming here.
At this moment, Elliot notices a piece of paper stapled on a nearby fence post. As he walks over to examine it, he notices that it is, in fact, another letter.
Hello again, Elliot. I'll keep this letter short and sweet. If you haven't noticed already, I'm not going to kill Tom Clover just yet. In fact, I was just testing you to see how far you would go to save your family. Now that I know you can make the tough decisions, I have one more for you to make. If you follow the path directly in front of you, you will find your wife and son tied to separate trees. I hope you're still able to run as fast as you used to. You will have 60 seconds to reach the end of the path and untie either your wife or son. Your time will start as soon as you step foot on the path. I truly hope you're not late, because I will pull the trigger at exactly 60 seconds. Good luck, Elliot. Signed, A.K.
Although age has begun to hinder Elliot's physical abilities, his body is filled with pure adrenaline. He darts down the path as if he were an Olympic sprinter running the 100-meter dash. With no time to spare, Elliot can now see his wife and son gagged and bound to the trees. Elliot has no idea how much time he has left, so without hesitation, he continues sprinting straight towards his son. Through heavy, deep breaths, Elliot shouts,
I'm here, son. I'm here.
As he inches closer to Elliot Jr., Elliot frantically begins to untie the ropes, when suddenly he hears a gunshot. He pauses for a split second and glances over at his wife, but the bullet wasn't aimed at her. Elliot's next thought is that he must have gotten Tom Clover, but then, strangely, Elliot begins to feel a burning sensation coming from his lower right shoulder blade. Elliot then notices the blood coming from just below his chest. Just as Elliot realizes the unimaginable, he hears a second gunshot. This time, when he glances over at his wife, her lifeless body dangles in the ropes. Just as Tom reaches the end of the path, Elliot shouts for help and then collapses on both of his knees. A few moments later, Elliot completely passes out. The next morning, Elliot's eyes slowly begin to open. It takes him only a few minutes for reality to set in and realize that he's in a hospital room. He then begins to continuously push the nurse's call button, while at the same time he shouts,
Hey, I need some help in here!
Without getting an immediate response, Elliot begins to rip out his own IVs. Before he even gets out of the bed, the room is now full of nurses and doctors.
Mr. Roberts, I'm Dr. Leams. I'm the doctor in charge of your medical care. I'm going to need you to lay back down, please, sir.
What about my family? Where's my wife and son?
Elliot shouts as his body begins to tremble.
Mr. Roberts, your body needs the medication we've been giving you. No, please lie down so we can put the IVs back in,
Dr. Leams says.
Doctor, please tell me if my family is all right or not, and then I'll do whatever you want.
Your son's hanging in there. The bullet passed straight through you and entered your son's head. If the bullet hadn't been slowed down by your body first, then we might not be having this conversation.
I have to see him,
Elliot said.
as he begins to sit back up.
Mr. Roberts, the best thing you can do for your son right now is to get healthy and strong yourself. I assure you, Mr. Roberts, he's doing just fine. They have him upstairs in the pediatric ward. I will personally take you upstairs myself just as soon as you are healthy enough. Do we have a deal?
Dr. Leems asks.
Yes,
Elliot replies as he lies back down. A few hours pass by, and then Elliot gets a visit.
How are you holding up? I'm doing better. Thank you for stopping by, Tom.
Elliot replies.
You don't have to thank me.
Have you heard anything about my wife?
Elliot asks.
I've heard that your son's going to make it.
Don't bullshit me here. No matter who I ask to give me a straight answer, I just need to confirm what I already feel.
Elliot replies as he grabs a hold of Tom's arm.
All right, Agent Roberts, all right. He shot her one time in the head, and from what I've heard around the station, she died instantly. I'm sorry, Agent.
Elliot interrupts.
I need to be alone now. Thank you, Tom.
Tom quietly turns around and walks out of the room. Elliot's emotions begin to flow uncontrollably.
Damn you, Jones. Damn you to hell. Why the fuck did you kill her? She had nothing to do with this.
Elliot screams out loud. Elliot Jr.'s surgery goes well, and the doctors have successfully removed the bullet. Although brain damage is a serious concern of the doctors, and several months of physical therapy will be needed for recovery, Elliot Jr. will survive. Elliot hears a slight knock on the door of his hospital room as it slowly begins to open.
How are you doing today, Elliot?
Dr. Leems asks.
I'm doing good, Doc. I'm ready to see my son.
Well, let me take a look at you. Check your vitals, and then I'll take you upstairs.
I feel fine,
Elliot replies.
I know, but I have to do my job and at least check you before I move you.
Dr. Leems checks Elliot's vitals, and everything looks good. He then puts him in a wheelchair and takes him to the elevator. The 30-second elevator ride seems like an eternity to Elliot. Finally, the doors open, and the doctor wheels Elliot into the hall of the pediatric ward.
Elliot, I have to warn you. He's actually doing a lot better than he may look right now.
I understand. Just take me to him, please. I have to see him.
Elliot impatiently replies. Dr. Leems takes Elliot to the nurse's station. The beautiful, young, blonde-haired nurse sitting behind the desk says,
Hello, doctor. And who do you have with you today?
This is Elliot, the man I've been telling you about.
Hello, Elliot. I'm Brittany.
Elliot politely nods his head and waves.
All right, Elliot. Brittany is going to take care of you from here. I have to get back downstairs.
Thank you, Dr. Leems,
Elliot says, as he extends his hand for a shake. Dr. Leems acknowledges the handshake before walking away. Brittany then takes Elliot to room number 347. Elliot notices his son's name written on a small piece of paper hanging right beside the doorframe.
Are you ready?
Brittany asks just before opening the door.
I am,
Elliot replies. Elliot's eyes fill with tears the instant he sees his son lying in the hospital bed. Elliot Jr.'s head is wrapped in medical bandages. What's visible of his young, innocent face seems to be swollen. Elliot can't even begin to count the number of tubes and instruments that are hooked up to his son. Although Elliot put up a good fight, he can no longer hold the tears back. Through heavy sobbing, he manages to mutter,
Is he going to be okay?
Nurse Brittany places her hand on Elliot's shoulder.
He's going to be fine. He has a very strong will to fight.
Can he hear me?
I like to believe he can. I have to be honest with you, Elliot. I've taken a liking to your son. I've come in here at least once a day and talked to him.
Thank you, Brittany. That means a lot,
Elliot says, as he tries to dry his eyes.
All right. Well, I'm going to go back to the desk and give you some time alone. I'll come back and check in on you a little later.
As the tears begin flowing heavily again, Elliot says,
Hey, buddy. The doctor says you're going to be fine. Can't really say that I'm surprised. I've always known that you are hard-headed like your old man. Son, I don't know.
Elliot begins to choke on his own words. As he tries to force the words out of his mouth, he feels a lump in the back of his throat. Elliot is now crying harder than he has ever cried in his life. He doesn't know how, but he finds the strength to force the words out.
Son, I'm sorry that I let this happen to you and your mother. I'll never be able to forgive myself, but I hope that one day you can forgive me.
Elliot's lips tremble as his words pass over them. Elliot takes his son by the hand.
Your mother.
Elliot stopped again to catch his breath.
Your mother didn't make it. I'm so sorry, son. I wish I could change places with her.
As soon as the words are finally out, they begin to sound like an echo in his ears. So he whispers in his son's ear and makes a promise to him in secrecy. Chapter 15.
Meanwhile, Jones is hiding out in the woods, making promises of his own.
Ha ha! I swore I would make your life miserable, and that's exactly what I intend to do, Agent Elliot Roberts,
Jones says to himself in a very creepy, almost demon-like voice. Jones continues talking to himself out loud, at times even arguing with himself.
I need to kill Elliot now, while I have the chance. No, not yet. It's not time. The plan is incomplete. But he's injured and heartbroken. He would never see it coming.
Just slow down and let the plan unfold. It's perfect, so keep it that way. After arguing with himself for nearly an hour, Jones begins to run through the plan over and over again in his head. Although Jones has been dubbed by the media as a psychopath, paranoid, schizophrenic, madman, and crazed killer, almost everyone overlooks the fact that he is highly intelligent. There's no record on file of Jones ever taking an IQ test, but Elliot scored a 167 during his interview with the FBI. To have an IQ of 167 is highly above average. However, Jones always seems to be one step ahead of Elliot. This can only mean one thing. Jones is clearly the smarter of the two men. Jones begins to write detailed instructions of the next move in the plan. His highly functioning mind is able to calculate exactly when and where Elliot will be based on the breadcrumbs Jones will intentionally leave behind. Jones seals the letter, puts a stamp on it, and proceeds to write an address and a name. Later that day, Jones makes the drop. The letter is now in the mailbox and will soon be on its way to its intended reader. Over the next several months, Elliot watches helplessly as his son undergoes brutal physical therapy. Elliot Jr. must now learn how to walk, talk, and even eat all over again. This is also a feat that is very demanding and challenging for Elliot as well. It's almost like having a newborn baby again. The only difference is, this time his wife isn't there to take the lead. Over the span of the last few months, all of Elliot's time and energy have gone into his son. He does, however, receive periodic updates on Jones, if you want to call them updates. In fact, there has been no news to report about Jones' whereabouts or actions. It seems that he has vanished off the face of the earth. Elliot begins to wonder if Jones' plan has been completed by injuring his son and killing his wife, or if the son of a bitch crawled into a hole, curled up, and died. Although the thought of it finally being over brings a smile to Elliot's face, the thought of not truly knowing of Jones' whereabouts brings chills to his body. Besides that, he made a promise to his son, and he intends on seeing it through. Nearly a year after the horrific murder of his wife, Elliot is able to return to work. Elliot Jr. is still recovering and will need several more months of grueling physical therapy. But at least, by now, he's fully able to understand just what happened. He also understands that the best chance of anyone catching Jones is his father. After all, he has done it once already. Therefore, Elliot Jr. demands that his father go back to work. Over the next year, Elliot Jr. has returned to school, and as for Elliot, he has been busy as usual. Elliot has tapped into all of his available resources in order to find any possible leads on Jones. Elliot has tracked down nearly everyone in Jones' past. His last resort was his old military buddies, all of which haven't heard from Jones, aka Alfred Knox, since he was discharged from the service. None of them seemed surprised to hear that he had become the worst serial killer in Minnesota's history. All but one, that is, Luke Johnson. When Elliot spoke with Luke over the phone, he seemed evasive and nervous. Elliot decides to go to Tupelo, Mississippi, and have a talk with Luke Johnson face-to-face. Elliot arrives at the address listed for Luke Johnson. He slowly proceeds down the gravel driveway until he reaches a double-wide trailer with a redwood deck. Elliot can't help but laugh. He can't help but think of the old country songs from the 90s. He briefly sings the song to himself.
This here's the queen of my double-wide trailer with the polyester curtains and the redwood deck.
But it's time for business. The fun and games are now over. As Elliot reaches the driveway and puts his car into park, he notices that there appears to be someone peeking through the blinds in one of the windows. As a precautionary measure, Elliot draws his service weapon and slowly approaches the door. Knock, knock, knock. The sound seems to echo through the woods. Although Elliot can hear someone moving around inside, no one answers. Knock, knock, knock. This time he knocks harder. The scorching, hot southern summer sun is blasting its rays on the front door of the trailer, which is primarily made of aluminum. With every knock, he can really feel his knuckles scorching. The door is hot enough to cook bacon on, and hell, way out here, he wouldn't be surprised if that's what they use it for. After the third time knocking, Elliot begins to shout.
I can hear you moving around in there. I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts with the FBI. I spoke with you on the phone about Alfred Knox, who goes by the name Harry Jones now.
Still no reply.
Luke Johnson, this is an urgent matter. I really need to speak with you. I can assure you that you're safe.
Right at this moment, Elliot hears a loud crash, which seems to be the sound of glass breaking. He now has probable cause.
Mr. Johnson, I'm coming in.
Elliot opens the door.
Are you okay, Mr. Johnson?
Elliot still doesn't get a response. He then notices a large pickle jar that lies on the floor, half broken.
It must have been what I heard,
Elliot thinks to himself. Elliot then hears a slight whimper coming from behind one of the doors in the kitchen. He opens the door, and much to his surprise, he finds Luke Johnson curled up in the pantry.
Don't kill me, I didn't say nothing!
The man screams in fear, with a deep southern drawl.
Mr. Johnson, I'm Agent Roberts with the FBI.
The man begins to cry as he continues to shout.
Please don't kill me, please don't!
Elliot squats down and grabs him by the shoulders and rolls him over.
Damn it, Mr. Johnson, look at me! I don't know who you think I am, but I'm not them. I'm not here to hurt you. If you need help, I'll get you help, but first I need you to help me.
The man slowly wipes his eyes and looks up at Elliot.
Oh, dear God, you're not. No, you're not.
I'm not what?
Elliot sternly replies.
You're not AK.
By AK, do you mean Alfred Knox?
Luke Johnson slowly nods his head yes.
That AK crazy bastard was here last week, just a day or two after I spoke with you on the phone.
What did he say when he was here?
Elliot asks.
He held a gun to my head and threatened me. He wanted to know if anyone had been around asking questions about him. I told him I hadn't seen anyone, but you had called me.
What did he say then?
He cocked his gun and said that if I ever talked to you again, that he would kill me. I knew he was crazy. I always did, but I didn't think he would do something like this. The crazy son of a bitch killed my dog right in front of me.
Did he say anything about where he might be going?
Elliot asks.
No, he just slit my dog's throat and walked away, and I haven't heard or seen from him since. But I will tell you this, he's a very smart man, and he was an excellent sniper. I wouldn't be surprised if he were somewhere around here watching us. That's why I didn't want to answer the door when you told me it was you.
Do you want me to get some protection out here for you?
Hell no. Then he would definitely know I talked to you. I'll just take my chances. But you should be on your way now, Agent.
Elliot hands Luke a business card and says,
if you see or hear from him again, give me a call immediately. Thanks for your time, Mr. Johnson.
Elliot then leaves and makes his way back to the airport. Now back at home in Quantico, Virginia, Elliot continues his investigation on Jones's whereabouts. Elliot's desk is littered with files, all the notes left by Jones, and even every newspaper article about the case. For hours, Elliot sifts through the stacks of papers on his desk.
There has to be something here. What am I missing?
Elliot says aloud, as he slams his fists into his desk. Over the next several months, Elliot spends almost all of his time looking over the case files, inch by inch, word by word, as if he expects there to be a new piece of evidence or just one more clue. But even with the countless hours spent looking at the files, and the fact that he now sees files in his sleep, there's still nothing to be found. Elliot fears deep down inside that he may never find Jones again, but at the same time, he knows he'll never stop looking until he does. Chapter 16. Jones sits by the 4-acre private lake that lies in the middle of the 70-acre piece of land that he acquired while in prison. Jones is a very intelligent man. He bought the land with some money he made from his book sales. He made certain the land could never be traced back to him. Jones paid for the land, but he had Kenneth Turnbow put it in his name and sign the papers. It's a beautiful piece of land, every writer's dream. In fact, he also has a gorgeous newly built 3-bedroom log cabin equipped with an exquisite stone fireplace which lies in the middle of the living room. The cabin has a spacious wraparound porch, which has a 30-foot walkway leading straight to the lake that branches off of it. Completely secluded and surrounded by lush forestry, the property is the ultimate hideout. Jones could easily live off the land and stay here for the rest of his life. But for men like Jones, that wouldn't be any fun, nor is it part of his plan. Jones writes another letter while sitting down by the lake.
Hello, partner. I truly hope all is well for you. May the rays of the sun continue to shine on your tarnished soul, and with each passing day, its radiant light may continue to make you stronger forevermore. I want you to know that the plan is on schedule, and everything is lining up exactly as we had hoped. And, as always, remember that bad friends ruin good habits. However, good friends, such as myself, strive to teach you new ones. That's about all I have to say for now. So, goodbye. Signed, your partner, A.K.
Jones then neatly folds the letter and places it in an envelope. He then addresses the envelope, leaving the return address blank. Next, he drives to the edge of his property line and places the letter in his mailbox. The following week, Jones receives a response to his letter. Just before opening the letter, he starts a fire in his fireplace. By this time, the sun has already been replaced in the sky by a bright new moon and a countless number of twinkling stars. With every light in the house off, the warm orange glow of the fire is all that now lights the living room, where Jones anxiously awaits to read his partner's response.
Dear AK,
I received your letter. I would like to thank you for your kind words. Every day is a struggle and an uphill battle. Your words always seem to calm the war that is raging inside of me. Sometimes I feel as if there are two souls inside of me. One soul fights for me to do the right thing, while the other is constantly pushing me towards revenge. The battle confuses my mind. I no longer know right from wrong. After all, how is revenge not right after what I've lost? But at the end of the day, your letters and teachings truly help me and keep me moving forward. I am so thankful for your friendship, and I cannot wait until our plan is finally complete and everyone involved has suffered for the things they've done. Please keep me posted on how everything is going with yourself and the plan. Signed, your partner.
After reading the letter, Jones balls it up and throws it into the fire.
Everything's working exactly as I planned. Your time is almost up, Elliot. You just don't know it yet. I sure hope you enjoy what life you do have left.
Jones says to himself, with the eerie glow of the fire casting a shadow across his face. His hair wildly overgrown and mangled, with his once boyish face now covered with matted hair and some form of a beard. He now looks like the devil he truly is. Meanwhile, Elliot's relentless work continues. Many of Elliot's co-workers are beginning to have concerns about his work ethics. Day in and day out, finding Jones and ending this is all Elliot ever thinks about. Many of the other agents can see the signs and the road he is heading towards. They know that if a case begins to get too personal, it can get under your skin and drive you mad. And how can this case not be personal to Elliot? After all, the low-life piece of shit did murder his wife and nearly killed his son as well. It has been nearly 3 years since the murder of Sharon Roberts. During this time, Elliot Jr. has completely healed. The doctor's fear of him having permanent brain damage have become nothing more than a fear. He's a perfectly normal, healthy 15-year-old boy. Although he doesn't remember much from that dreadful day, he has heard the story. With the dramatic injury he sustained to his head, Elliot Jr. is no longer allowed to participate in contact sports. Thus, his football career has been cut short before it ever really began. But that's okay with Elliot Jr. He has recently decided on a new path and career in life. He wants to follow in his father's footsteps and one day work for the FBI. While all is well with Elliot Jr., Elliot Sr. is not so lucky. He will never be able to forget what happened that day. And, until he captures Jones, he will carry this heavy burden of guilt. His productivity at work is suffering the consequences. He now lacks the drive and willpower to help others, when he can't even help himself capture the one responsible for killing his own wife. Needless to say, his career is on a downward spiral. As for Jones, he is still lost in the wind. No one has seen nor heard from him. That is, not anyone that knows about anyway. Over the past few years, Jones has kept in close contact with his secret partner. In fact, they have just arranged for their first face-to-face meeting since they began writing letters to one another. The bus arrives at the local gas station that doubles as a Greyhound bus stop in Green Forest, Maine. Green Forest is a tiny town in the middle of nowhere. In fact, with a population of 247, Jones was surprised that Green Forest was able to obtain its own dot on the map. When the doors open, only one person exits the bus. Jones cautiously approaches.
"How was your trip?"
Jones asks.
"It was long,"
is all his secret partner replies.
"All right. Well, my truck is over there. Let's get you to the house."
They get into the truck and begin their 30-minute drive to Jones's house. Although neither one of them know this yet, the next 30 minutes will soon become the most important 30 minutes of either one of their lives. Meanwhile, back at Quantico, Elliot is called to the director of the FBI operations office.
"Come on in, Elliot. Have a seat. How are you doing today?"
Director Bill Newton asks Elliot.
"I'm all right. I'm just working on a few cases."
Newton slowly nods his head and then replies.
"There have been a lot of concerns regarding you within the department."
"Concerns? What do you mean?"
"Elliot, look, we've been friends for a long time, so I'm bringing this to your attention as a friend, not the director."
"I don't understand, Bill. People are talking shit behind my back and you call me in your office? Some friend."
Elliot replies as he lets out a spiteful snicker.
"Elliot, do you realize that you had a 98% closing rate on all of your cases before..."
Elliot interrupts.
"Before what, Bill?
Say it! Before what?"
he shouts.
"You get to go home to your wife every day. You have no idea of the burden I carry, so don't you dare bring that up to me. I show up for work every day, and I do my job."
"All right, Elliot. Now I'm speaking to you as a director. Before Jones escaped and killed Sharon, you had a 98% closing rate. Do you even know what your rate is now? Here, let me show you. 0. Elliot, that's right. You haven't closed one case in the last 3 years. You have no idea how hard it was for me to keep you on. They've been calling for your job for quite some time now, Elliot. I pulled a couple of strings to keep you, but I don't have any more strings to pull."
"So what are you saying, Bill? Are you firing me?"
"Damn it, Elliot.
No, I'm not firing you, but I am requesting you take some time off.
And do what, Bill?
I don't care what you do, just as long as it doesn't involve the FBI or Jones. I was able to pull enough of those strings to get you 6 months off, paid for personal leave. What you do with your time is up to you, but as a friend, I suggest you spend some time with your boy and get your shit together.
Then what?
Elliot asks.
Then you come back as the agent I know you are, start closing cases again and make us all look good.
Elliot doesn't say another word. He simply turns and walks out of the office. Elliot arrives at home and begins to plan a weekend fishing trip for himself and Elliot Jr. Elliot Jr. is surprised to see his father at home when he arrives from school.
You're home early today. Is everything all right?
Yeah, everything's fine. Took the next couple days off.
For what?
Elliot Jr. asks, the pure shock showing all over his face. Elliot Jr. knows his father never takes off work.
They're sending me on a case next week. I'm going to be gone out of state for a few months, so I figured we could spend a few days together. Go fishing or something.
All right, sounds great, Dad. When are we leaving?
As soon as you go pack your bags. I've already got all the gear and tents together.
Sweet. Let me grab a few things. I'll be ready in a minute,
Elliot Jr. says before sprinting up the stairs. Although Elliot feels the guilt of lying to his son, he hasn't seen his son this excited about anything since before his mother was killed. Just seeing that spark in his son again fills Elliot's heart with joy and overpowers the guilt he feels inside. Chapter 17. After a great, much-needed, long weekend getaway, Elliot and Elliot Jr. arrive back at home on Monday morning.
I had a lot of fun hanging out with you, Dad. I know you're always busy with work, but we should try to do that a little more often.
I had fun, too. And I think we should spend more time together as well, son. I need to get some rest for now. I will be heading out of town later tonight.
It must be a big case if you agree to go out of town for it,
Elliot Jr. replies.
It is,
Elliot says with a half-hearted grin. After packing his bags, Elliot takes a 3-hour nap. It is now time for him to head to the airport and catch his plane to Minnesota. Once Elliot arrives at the airport in Minnesota, he is still an hour away from Greenland. Elliot booked his plane ticket and rental car the same day that he and Elliot Jr. left for their camping trip. Elliot walks over to the front counter at the rental car service center, which is conveniently located in the airport.
I wonder if the airline companies own the rental cars too,
Elliot jokingly thinks to himself.
Hello, welcome to Choice Rentals, where the choice is always yours. My name is Todd. How can I help you today, sir?
A young blue-eyed kid with spiky blonde hair says from behind the counter. Elliot's first thought is,
how much gel does it take to make his hair stand like that?
And the next is,
why in the world would anybody purposely make themselves look like a porcupine?
Whatever the reasons, Elliot truly doesn't care. He is only here to get his car, not make friends. So he politely replies,
hi, Todd. I have a reservation for a rental.
Great. Well, you made the right choice today. I just need to see your license and credit card, please.
Elliot then hands Todd his license and credit card.
Here you are.
Todd swipes away on the computer, as if he were trying to run a marathon with his fingers. Elliot surprisingly finds himself impressed with the kid's typing skills.
Hmm.
Todd mumbles, then makes some odd sound by pushing his tongue against the back of his teeth and then sucking it back.
What? What is it?
Elliot asks.
Well, we might have a little problem here.
What sort of problem?
You do, but you don't have a reservation.
What in the hell is that supposed to mean?
Elliot asks with a frustrated tone in his voice.
Well, sir, this is the problem. I can see that you called in to make a reservation.
Yes,
Elliot interrupts.
The problem is, whoever it was that you spoke with didn't close the reservation out. Therefore, you don't actually have a reservation and we're completely booked.
What the fuck do you mean I don't have a reservation? I have a confirmation order right here.
Elliot slams a piece of paper on the counter.
Sir, I know that you called, but the ticket was never closed out. Therefore, you were never charged for the vehicle, which unfortunately means you don't have a reservation. We also don't have any open vehicles on the lot.
Well, I'd like to speak to a manager because this is fucking ridiculous. I'm 1,000 miles away from home, over an hour away from my destination, and you're telling me that I'm stuck here?
I understand your frustration, but there's no reason to speak to me in that manner, Mr. Roberts.
Just get me your manager,
Elliot demands.
Mr. Roberts, I am the manager, and I'm terribly sorry, but there's nothing I can do. I can give you a voucher so that your next rental will be free of charge.
Unbelievable.
Elliot shakes his head, chuckles, then walks away. After trying several of the other major rental car providers located in the airport, each of which tell him the same thing, they're all booked up. Elliot has no other choice but to call the only person he knows in the area. A little over an hour later, his ride finally arrives.
Hello, Agent Roberts. Welcome back to Minnesota.
Thanks, Tom. I'm sorry I had to call you.
Nonsense. Don't worry about that. I don't mind at all. Just throw your bags in the trunk and we'll be on our way,
Tom replies. They'll have an hour ride to catch up on things. It has been over a year since the murder of Elliot's wife.
So how's your boy doing?
Tom asks.
He's great. I actually just took him camping. He's a really good kid. He has his mother's heart. I just hope it stays that way. How about you, Tom? How have you been?
I've been busy, Agent Roberts.
You can call me Elliot, Tom.
All right, well, I've been busy, Elliot.
Well, that's good, I hope.
Elliot replies with a half-cocked smile.
It is. In fact, if you have a few minutes when we get into town, I'd like to show you some things that I've been working on.
Yeah, we can do that.
The two men don't really say anything else to one another the rest of the way to Greenland.
Home sweet home,
Tom says as they enter into Greenland. A few minutes later, they pull down the long driveway which leads to Mrs. Green's house. The car comes to a stop. Both men exit the vehicle, Elliot a little slower than Tom.
Come on in, it's all right,
Tom says as he waves his hand in a motioning gesture. Elliot glances over at the barn and takes a deep breath as vivid images of what took place with Jones and Morstead that horrible day. Tom stops at the front porch and looks back at Elliot.
Are you coming?
He asks.
Yeah,
Elliot replies as he walks over to the porch. This place brings back terrible memories, memories that he wishes he could wipe clean from his mind. But the one thing about this place that he knows he will never forget is the sound of the squeaky old steps. Elliot is almost in shock when he places his foot on the first step. With the steps now bearing his weight, it is as quiet as a mouse.
I guess you have been busy,
Elliot says.
Ha ha!
Tom laughs.
Yeah, I fixed those steps a while back, but that's not what I have to show you, Elliot,
Tom says as he opens the front door and motions for Elliot to enter. Tom then leads Elliot down the hallway to a bedroom on the right. The only furniture in the room is an old wooden desk and a metal swivel chair that has seen its better days. The walls are covered with newspaper clippings, handwritten notes, and a large map of the United States. The map has colored thumbtacks pinned to it.
What's going on here, Tom?
I told you, I've been busy. I knew with everything that happened with you and your son that you wouldn't be able to investigate the case to the best of your abilities. So I figured I would help.
Elliot shakes his head as he stares at the walls. He is offended at first. The thought that someone thinks he can't do his job fills his body with rage. But then he thinks about the situation and realizes that if anyone is as close to this case as he is, it would be Tom.
All right, so tell me what you found,
Elliot replies. Tom stands slightly in shock for a moment. Even he knows this comes off as borderline crazy. Then he begins to ramble with his words, quickly flying through the air like a propeller from a motorboat, chopping through the water.
This is a clipping of when you arrested Jones. Over here, there's one of you and your son leaving the hospital, and right here...
Slow down, Tom,
Elliot interrupts.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. Tell me about the map.
The red pins are everywhere that I know for a fact Jones has been since this all began. The yellow pins are the places I think he could be now.
So what's your logic behind the yellow pins?
Elliot asks.
Well, I have this one here because he knows the area better than anyone. At least that's what a lot of the locals tell me.
Tom says as he points at a yellow pin placed on the map in a wooded area just outside of Greenland.
All right, and the others?
Well, this one is in Quantico because I thought maybe there's a chance that he wanted to keep an eye on you.
Elliot nods his head in agreement, then rolls his hand in the air as if he's telling Tom to continue. So Tom continues.
These others were just people he used to know, so you can't really rule them out,
Tom says as he shrugs his shoulders and tilts his head to the left.
So what's the green pin?
Elliot asks.
I'm glad you asked. The green pin is the strongest possibility of where I think Jones might be hiding based on my investigation.
What makes you so sure about this location?
Tom digs through the papers on his desk.
Here it is,
he says as he hands a small stack of papers to Elliot.
It's right here. Jones only had one visitor while he was incarcerated. That's a copy of his visitor's log. There's only one name on the log, once a month for nearly 2 years, Rose Jenkins.
So who the hell is she?
Elliot asks.
That's where it gets tricky. Took me a while, but I finally figured it out. Her visit started a month after her cousin Kenneth Turnbull was released, so I dug around and found out that he was also Jones's cellmate. Coincidence, maybe, but highly unlikely,
Tom says with a smile.
So I continued digging, trying to find out everything that I could about him. I found out that he recently bought this piece of land,
Tom says as he points to the green pin on the map.
Well done, Tom. Well done. Now that you've shared all this with me, I'll tell you a secret. I'm not officially here on the case. In fact, they asked me to take some time off to get away from the case. So it looks like we're going to Green Forest, Maine.
Chapter 18. Meanwhile, as Elliot and Tom make their way to Green Forest, Maine, Jones is at the bus stop saying farewell to his new partner. Jones and his mysterious partner have grown close over the last few weeks. Jones has taught him the basics of becoming a criminal mastermind. Now it's time to send him home, where it's up to him to master what he's been taught. Jones stands in the gravel parking lot and waves as the bus drives away. He doesn't really know why, but for a moment, he feels the urge to cry. Is it possible for a psychotic killer to actually have feelings for another human being? Surely it can't be possible, especially when it comes to a monster like Jones. Whatever it was, as quickly as the feelings came, it has passed without a single tear being shed. Jones gets in his truck and heads back to his place in the woods to continue working on his plan. With the true criminal genius that Jones possesses inside, and all the years he's had to work on his plan, there's one thing he overlooked. Tom Clover. Not even Jones would have thought that a simple pawn like Tom would turn into a king's knight. After hours of tweaking and perfecting his plan, Jones decides to head into town for some groceries. After entering the grocery store, Jones quickly gathers all the things he needs, mostly sodas and TV dinners. However, while standing in the checkout line, he suddenly gets the urge for something else. The cashier is a beautiful, young, curly, red-headed goddess with a perfect body. In the back of his mind, Jones estimates the girl to be 18 or 19 years old. She has emerald green eyes that seem to dance every time she speaks. She's approximately 5'2" tall, can't weigh more than 115, with endless curves that seem to go in all the right directions. Jones is amazed and can't take his eyes off of the girl. His heart begins to race. It's pounding against his chest like a lion trying to get out of its cage. He's next in line.
Thank you. Have a great day.
He hears the girl say to the overweight kid in front of him buying a candy bar.
Hello, did you find everything okay today?
She asks as she smiles at Jones. If she only knew what the monster standing in front of her was really thinking, she would have kept her mouth shut instead of flashing her beautiful smile. Jones doesn't say a word. He simply nods his head. She scans his items and gives him the total.
That will be $24.87, please,
she says. Jones hands her a 20 and a $10 bill, touching her radiant skin that shines like porcelain in the lights. Jones now knows he wants her. No, he needs her. He gets his change and then leaves the store.
Oh, that guy gives me the creeps,
she says to a coworker. Hours have passed, but Jones hasn't left the parking lot. He is patiently waiting for the girl to get off work. Finally, he sees her exit the doors, and to his amusement, she is alone. He watches as she slowly walks to her vehicle. He waits for her to start her vehicle, and then he makes his move. With his lights off, he slowly drives in the dark, waiting for the girl to back out of her spot. He times it perfectly. She backs out and slightly bumps the front of Jones's truck. The girl quickly pulls forward, puts the vehicle in park, and jumps out.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't even see you there. Are you okay?
She frantically says as Jones exits the truck.
I'm fine, and I don't think you hit me hard enough to do any damage. Mine looks fine too. So should we call and report it?
She replies.
I don't think there's any reason to do that.
The girl lets out a sigh of relief and says,
good, my dad would kill me. Well, we wouldn't want that, now would we?
Jones replies with a crooked smile.
Again, I'm so sorry, but I really should be getting home now.
No need to rush, Jones says, as he inches closer to the girl. She tries to back up, but pushes against her car.
You know, on second thought, maybe we should report it,
she says, as she reaches in her pocket for her phone. I wouldn't do that if I were you, Jones says, as he shows the girl his large hunting knife. She is now frozen in fear. She tries to speak, but can only mumble.
What are you?
Now, calm down, beautiful, Jones interrupts as he softly touches the girl's face. She pulls her head back away from his hand. I just want to talk to you. Don't be afraid. How about we take a ride to my house and get to know each other? Who knows? You might end up liking me, Jones suggests.
I don't think,
she starts to say before Jones interrupts.
Not really a request,
he says as he pulls out his knife. Just get in the truck and you won't get hurt, I promise. Jones opens the driver's side door as the girl begins to tremble and cry. The fear of not knowing who this man is and the fact that he has a large knife, the girl does as she is told. On the long, secluded drive back to his house, Jones tries to make conversation with the girl.
So, what's your name, gorgeous?
He asks. She doesn't speak. All she does is shake her head and cry.
Look now, don't be rude. I'm just trying to get to know you. Look at me. I promise you, nothing will happen to you as long as you behave like a proper lady. Now, I'll ask you again. What is your name?
Through her waterlogged eyes, the girl manages to mutter her name.
Sam. Samantha.
My name is Harry, but everyone calls me Jones. It's very nice to meet you, Samantha.
Yes, sir. You too.
You sure are gorgeous.
Thank you. I bet you have a perfect little body hidden under those clothes, don't you?
No, sir,
she replies as she begins heavily sobbing again.
Well, I just don't believe that,
Jones says as he places his hand on the girl's thigh. She flinches but doesn't say anything.
How about you take your shirt off and show me,
Jones says as he slightly tugs on her shirt. Bawling with her hands covering her eyes, she shouts,
I can't! I can't!
Jones grabs her thigh and squeezes as hard as he can. She screams in agonizing pain.
I told you nothing would happen to you as long as you act like a lady. Now, are you ready to do that?
He asks.
Yes, yes,
she mumbles through the pain.
Good. I'll give you another try, Samantha. Just a little warning, darling. The next time you refuse me, I'll use my knife. Now, slowly take off your shirt.
She does as she's told.
Good, good,
Jones mutters in excitement. Now the bra, he says. She reaches one hand behind her back and unhooks her bra. Her breasts are now fully exposed in the moonlight.
Those are tiny, but perfect,
Jones says as he reaches over and grabs a handful.
I better stop. I might ruin all the fun,
Jones says as he puts a hand on the steering wheel. After a few minutes of silence, Samantha asks,
Can I put my shirt back on now?
No, I still want to be able to look at you if I decide to glance over there.
Samantha continues to cry, but for fear of losing her life, she leaves herself completely exposed. As they draw closer to Jones's secluded house, he already has visually gone over all the things he plans to do to Samantha. However, when they reach the end of the long dirt road that leads to his house, his plans are suddenly forced to change. It looks like they won't be alone after all. There's a car parked close to his house.
Who in the hell is at my house?
He says. Samantha is briefly filled with a moment of relief. Although she may be young, she's not stupid. She has known all along what Jones was planning on doing with her once he had her isolated.
Maybe you should just let me go. I swear I won't tell anyone,
she pleads.
Shut the fuck up,
Jones says as he backhands her across the face. Blood begins to pour from her nose as her moment of relief passes by. Jones opens a truck door and drags Samantha out by her hair. Her legs are flailing in the air as she screams.
Stop! Somebody help me, please!
Tom is near the front door when he hears a commotion. He opens the door and steps out onto the front porch. Blinded by the headlights from the truck, all he can see is what looks to be two silhouettes. Tom hears the screams again.
Please help me!
What's going on?
Tom shouts with a stern tone to his voice.
Tom Clover? How in the hell did you find me?
Jones says as he realizes who the man standing on his porch is.
It doesn't really matter. I'm going to gut you like a pig anyway,
Jones says as he begins to push the girl to the side and make his move.
Elliot, it's Jones! Get out here now!
Tom shouts as loud as he can. Jones stops in his tracks. Jones knows Tom wouldn't put up much of a fight, but he also knows he might need more than a knife when it comes to Agent Roberts.
That's far enough, Elliot. I have a hostage,
Jones demands as Elliot rushes onto the porch.
Don't do anything stupid, Jones. I think we both know you killed enough people,
Elliot replies.
Throw your weapon on the ground,
Jones says.
It doesn't have to go down like this. We can talk about...
Elliot, do it now or I'll cut her fucking throat,
Jones says as he presses his knife against Samantha's neck. Feeling the ice-cold blade digging into her skin, she screams.
Please, he has a knife! Just do what he wants!
All right, Jones, all right,
Elliot says as he tosses his gun off the porch and into the dirt.
I did it. Now what? How does this play out, Jones?
Elliot asks.
You two are going to go back into my house and shut the fucking door.
And if we refuse?
Tom replies.
Then I'll kill her, which would be a shame, because she's too young and far too gorgeous to die like this.
Jones replies as he lets out a disturbing, evil cackle sort of laugh.
All right, we're going.
Tom and Elliot enter the house and close the door behind them. A few moments later, they hear the roaring sound of a motorcycle starting up. As they hear the motor rev up, Elliot looks out the window and sees the bike pull away. He then runs out onto the porch as Tom follows close behind him.
He was alone on that bike. Go check on the girl. I'm going after him,
Elliot shouts as he sprints towards Tom's car. With his adrenaline rushing and not wanting to let Jones escape again, Elliot doesn't even take a few seconds needed to pick up his gun. As Elliot races away in pursuit, leaving a cloud of dust of his own, Tom rushes over to check on the girl. His eyes fill with tears as he sees the blood-stained dirt beneath the girl's lifeless body. He drops to his knees, grabs the girl, and pulls her up in his arms. As he holds her in his arms and rocks back and forth, he sobs heavily for this girl he doesn't even know. All he knows is that the monster that did this killed the only woman he ever loved, Jennifer Cole. All at once, the brutal memories of that day are flashing back like a bad movie in his mind. With his hands and clothes now covered in the girl's blood, he whispers,
"He'll pay for this. He'll pay for everything he's ever done, I promise."
As his lips begin to tremble and his words become more and more clear, he mumbles,
"One last thing. I still love you, Jennifer. I always will."
Elliot speeds down the dirt road, following the trail of dust Jones is leaving behind. Finally, he's close enough to see a taillight. They're racing at speeds nearing 100 miles an hour. The faster he goes, the harder it is to control the car, but Elliot doesn't care. As the car sways back and forth across the road, the only thing he cares about, in this moment, is capturing Jones. Just as Elliot starts to gain some ground, Jones tries to make a hard right turn. As the bike starts to skid uncontrollably, Jones jumps off. He hits the ground at high speeds, but softens his blow by rolling with the fall. From a short distance away, Elliot can see Jones pop up from the cloud of dust. Jones leaps over a barbed wire cattle fence, which leads to an open field. Just beyond the field lie large patches of heavily wooded areas. Elliot is a crazed man on a mission. He is determined that this time, Jones will not get away. He slows his speed and turns hard to the right, where he then plows right through the fence. Jones darts across the field. He's fast, but he's no match for the car. Elliot quickly catches up to him and slightly opens the driver's side door. As he drives past Jones, he forces the door open with his left foot. It's a direct hit. The door slams hard into Jones' back. Jones collapses instantly. Elliot stops the car and runs to Jones. As he lies in agonizing pain, Jones somehow manages to say,
"Damn! I didn't know you had it in you! Nice move!"
Elliot cuffs Jones behind his back and puts him in the back of the car. Elliot then drives Jones back to the house. When he pulls up, he notices that Tom is kneeling on the ground with the girl held tight in his arms. He parks the vehicle and makes his way towards Tom, leaving Jones in the back seat. As he approaches closer, he can now see that Tom is rocking the girl back and forth, covered in blood. As he places his hand on Tom's shoulder, he says,
"It's over, Tom. We got him."
Tom stops rocking, but remains silent.
"He's in cuffs in the back seat of your car. It's finally over. It's time for him to go back to prison and pay for what he's done."
"Did you hear that, Jennifer? We got him now,"
Tom says. Elliot now realizes that Tom sees the girl as his dead ex, Jennifer Cole. Elliot's eyes begin to fill with tears as Tom starts singing,
"If you get there before I do, don't give up on me. I'll meet you when my chores are through."
Tears begin to flow heavily from Tom's eyes. His lips are trembling. His whole body is now shaking as he finishes the heartbroken words to the song.
"I don't know how long I'll be, but I'm not going to let you down. Darling, wait and see. And between now and then, till I see you again, I'll be loving you. Love me."
Barely able to hold back his own tears, Elliot squats down next to Tom and softly whispers,
"It's all right, Tom. Jennifer can rest in peace now that it's over. Just take your time. I'm going to go look around the house some more."
Tom just continues to cry, still not saying a single word to Elliot. With Elliot now inside the house, looking through Jones's things, Tom suddenly stops crying. His body is no longer trembling. It's as if he is a completely different person from moments ago. Tom gets up and walks over to the car. He stands there and stares at Jones right in the eyes. Then Jones suddenly throws that damn crooked smile in Tom's direction. Completely filled with rage and hatred, Tom looks down and sees Elliot's gun still lying in the dirt.
"Son of a bitch! You'll never hurt anyone else again!"
Tom mumbles to himself as he reaches for the gun. Without hesitation, Tom opens the back door and fires three shots. Pop, pop, pop. The loud gunfire echoes throughout the dark night. The first shot hit Jones in the arm, the second in the side of his ribcage, puncturing the lung on its way into Jones's body. As if the two gunshots and a punctured lung weren't good enough to kill the monster, the third and final shot connected with the side of Jones's head. Blood splatters all over the windows in the back of the car, surely mixed with pieces of Jones' highly intelligent brain. Blood pours out of Jones's head and mouth. As the man responsible for taking so many lives now lies dead in the backseat of Tom's car, no one will ever be taunted by that crooked smile again. Chapter 19. As Elliot hears the gunshots, he reaches for his service weapon and quickly realizes that it's not there.
"Shit!"
he says to himself as he runs for the front door. As he carefully inches his way onto the porch, he notices Tom standing by the car with the back door open. He then notices that Tom is holding a gun. His gun.
"This is bad, real bad,"
he thinks to himself before shouting,
"Tom, what did you do?"
"Now it's over. He will never hurt anyone else again,"
Tom says, as he turns and looks in Elliot's direction.
"Tom, you don't understand what you have done. I wasn't supposed to be here. I was supposed to be taking time away from the case, remember? Now my service weapon was used to kill the man. How does it look on me, Tom?
I'm sorry, Elliot. It had to be done,
Tom says as he pushes the barrel of the gun against his temple.
What are you doing, Tom? Don't do that. It'll be all right, man. We'll figure out something,
Elliot pleads. With empty eyes, Tom looks at Elliot and says,
She's the only woman that I ever loved, and now he's dead. My chores are through.
Tom pulls the trigger and dies instantly.
No, Tom!
Elliot shouts as he drops to his knees. With his hands vigorously pulling at his own hair, he says to himself,
What the fuck am I going to do now? Three bodies, no witnesses, and I wasn't even supposed to be here.
After regaining his composure, Elliot finally has come up with a plan. Although he doesn't like the plan, nor the thought of what he has to do, he has no choice. He knows that Tom has a track record of disappearing, and he really doesn't have anyone that will miss him anyway. As for Jones, no one knew where he was, so he plans to keep it that way. But the girl, that's where it gets tricky. So young and beautiful, surely there will be someone out there missing her, and Elliot couldn't live with himself knowing she's not coming home while her family is still out there looking for her. Deep into the woods, he finds the perfect spot to dig. He spends the majority of the night digging a large grave, big enough for two. Next, he searches Jones' pockets for keys to his truck. He then places Jones and Tom in the freshly dug grave and burns their bodies to get rid of any evidence that may have been left behind. He places the girl in the backseat of Tom's car, and then searches the area around the car to find four shell casings from his gun. He sets fire to the car, burning Samantha along with it. Then Elliot gets in Jones' truck, drives away, and swears to himself to never so much as think of this moment ever again. Nearly a year has passed since that day in Green Forest, Maine, and although Elliot didn't actually kill anyone, he can't help but feel that he got away with murder. Elliot's life at work is great now that he no longer focuses his attention on Jones. As far as the FBI is concerned, Jones is still somewhere out there, but as long as he isn't killing anyone, he doesn't take priority over the open cases. But at home, Elliot has struggled to maintain his relationship with his son. Elliot is slowly becoming an alcoholic. He drinks from the time he gets home until the time he goes to bed every night, as if he's trying to drown the memories of that night out of his mind. Elliot Jr. can't help but notice the problem his father now has with drinking. He's tried talking to his father on several different occasions, and each time ends with the same results. His father saying,
I'm fine. Don't worry about me, son. Just make sure your own life is in order.
Although it hurts him to see the man, which he once thought of as a superhero, now quickly aging and reeking of alcohol, Elliot Jr. does his best to ignore the situation and focuses on never becoming his father. Over the next 8 years, Elliot Jr. has grown into an incredible young man. He's worked extremely hard to get to where he is today. He recently graduated with honors from Stanford University. He quickly followed in his father's footsteps and graduated at the top of his class in the FBI Academy. Now, at age 24, Elliot Jr. has officially become his father, Special Agent Elliot Roberts. As for Elliot Sr., he has definitely seen better days. In fact, he's now surviving on borrowed time. He and Elliot Jr. have become close over the past few years after he was diagnosed with liver cancer 5 years ago. Elliot Sr. takes the tragedy as a miracle. After years of heavy alcoholic binging and pushing his son further and further away, the diagnosis finally forced him to put down the bottle and rekindle his relationship with his only son. Elliot Jr. now stands at 6'1½" and weighs 220 pounds. To go along with his intimidating physique, he has a deep, raspy voice that almost sounds like a lion at feeding time. Elliot Jr. sits at his desk looking over the files from a kidnapping case he solved last week.
Roberts, what the hell are you doing? Didn't you solve that case already?
One of the other agents says as he approaches Elliot Jr.'s desk.
Yeah, I did. I'm just giving it one last look to make sure there weren't any loose ends, that's all.
You know, I never met your old man, but I heard he was a hell of an agent. A bunch of the old heads upstairs are saying you're just like him.
What's your point, Telly?
Elliot Jr. snaps back.
Damn, Roberts, don't bite my head off. It was a compliment. All I meant is that you're a great agent, and I'm sure you didn't leave any loose ends.
Sorry, Telly, I just got off the phone with my dad. He isn't doing so well.
Sorry to hear that, man.
It is what it is,
Elliot Jr. replies. At this moment, Elliot Jr.'s phone begins to ring.
Special Agent Roberts, can I help you?
He says as he answers the phone.
Roberts, this is Director Jerry Bell. I need you to come up to my office right away.
I'll be right there,
Elliot Jr. says as he hangs up the phone. He then tells Telly that he has to run as he makes his way to the elevator. Director Jerry Bell used to work with Elliot Sr. as an agent.
Come in and take a seat,
Director Bell says as he points to an open chair across from his desk.
What's going on, sir?
Elliot Jr. says as he sits in the chair. After taking a deep breath, the agent says,
I have a new case for you.
All right. Well, what is it?
That's where it gets complicated. There have been 4 recent murders in Greenland, Minnesota, once per week over the last month.
So they're thinking it's a serial killer? Elliot Jr. asked.
Yes, the killer leaves a note at the crime scene.
What did the note say?
That's irrelevant, Roberts. What really matters is the fact of where the killings are taking place, how the killer is killing them, and the fact that he signs every letter AK.
Sorry, I don't follow you, sir.
There was a serial killer years ago that the media named the Saw Killer, short for Sniper at Work. He started killing in Greenland, Minnesota with a 50 caliber sniper rifle, the same caliber being used in the murders now. The killer's name was Alfred Knox. Your father worked the case, so he knows it better than anyone. I need you to take these files to your father and have him look them over.
Okay, I can do that. But when he does, is the case mine?
If you still want it after you talk to your father, then yes, it's yours.
All right, I'll take the files over there now,
Elliot Jr. says. The agent hands him the files, and Elliot Jr. walks out of the office. He parks in a large, mostly empty parking lot. He grabs the files and heads for the front door. As he approaches closer, the large double doors slide open automatically.
Hello, Mr. Roberts. Your father has been waiting on you,
the woman from behind the counter says. He politely waves as he walks by. The great Special Agent Roberts, Elliot Jr. thinks to himself as he opens the door to room number 112. No longer able to care for himself, Elliot Sr. now lives in an assisted living home. Once the cancer started taking a turn for the worse, Elliot Sr. made the decision to move here.
Hey, Dad,
Elliot Jr. says as he walks in.
How are you, son?
I'm good, Dad. How are you?
I've been better, but I'm doing all right. What do you have in your hand?
Elliot Sr. asks.
It's a new case that I just received today.
I know the drill. Top secret, FBI classified information. It's on a need-to-know basis, and I don't need to know,
Elliot Sr. says. Both men begin to laugh.
Just the opposite. I was told that I might need your help with this one.
Really? Well, I would be honored.
Elliot Jr. hands his father the files. Chapter 20. As Elliot opens the folder, he sees a mugshot and his heart begins to race. He can hear his heartbeat pounding in his ears. Under the mugshot is a name, Alfred Knox, followed by AKA Harry Jones. He continues looking through the files, saying that there have been 4 new murders in Greenland, fitting Jones' profile perfectly. He then notices a letter addressed to Special Agent Elliot Roberts. He opens the letter and begins to read it. Halfway through the letter, he begins to tremble, so he folds it up and puts it back in the envelope.
What did the letter say?
Elliot Jr. asks.
Nothing. It doesn't concern you. It was meant for me.
What do you mean it doesn't concern me? This is my case now, so it does concern me.
Son, please, don't take this case.
What are you talking about? Why? Why wouldn't I take the case?
You have no idea what this case has done to our family, son. I'm begging you. Please, just leave it alone.
Elliot Sr. says, as his eyes begin to fill with tears.
Do you think it's the same person committing the murders now?
I said, leave it alone, son. Take your case and get the hell out of here.
Elliot Jr. has never seen his father this scared of anything in his life. Now he has to know more, so he pushes harder.
Look, Dad, I'm not a kid anymore. You don't have to protect me now. Besides, I'm taking this case whether you like it or not, so you might as well just help me.
As his lips begin to tremble and the tears flow from his eyes, Elliot Sr. says,
if you look at the names listed under his victims, you will find your mother's and her sister's.
Are you telling me that this is the man that killed my mother?
Yes.
Then why in hell would you try to stop me from finally catching this bastard?
It's complicated,
Elliot Sr. replies.
Then unfucking complicated,
Elliot Jr. says as he slightly raises his voice.
The day your mother died, I made a promise to you. When you were lying in the hospital bed fighting for your life, I whispered in your ear. I promised you that one day I would catch the monster that killed your mother and put you in that bed.
Well, it looks like you lied, because the bastard is still killing.
It's not him, son.
How can you be so sure?
Because I burned his body a long time ago.
Are you confessing to a murder? You know what? Never mind. Don't answer that. Just stop talking, Dad.
No, it's too late for that. I told you to leave it alone. Now you need to hear the whole story. Besides that, we both know I'll be dead in a month anyway, so what are they going to do to me? Now sit your ass down and listen.
All right,
Elliot Jr. replies as he sits in the chair next to his father's bed.
When it all started, there were 2 local detectives working on the case, Jimmy Morstead and his partner Harry Jones,
Elliot Sr. says as he points to Jones' mugshot.
One of the lead suspects was a drifter named Tom Clover, we set a trap to capture Clover. During this time, Morstead was murdered, and Jones told me it was Clover. At that time, I had no reason to believe otherwise. Over time, Clover finally turned himself in. When I interrogated him, he had an outrageous story about how he saw Jones kill Morstead. Out of curiosity, I did some digging and found out that there was a lot more to Jones than what met the eye. During the course of the investigation, it turned out that Jones, in fact, was Alfred Knox, and that Tom's Clover story was true.
All right, so what does any of that have to do with now?
Elliot Jr. says.
Just sit back and listen. I'm getting to it. Long story short, I got wrapped up in the case after he escaped from prison and killed your mother. I was made to take a 6-month leave of absence, which I did, except for the fact that I went to Greenland looking for Jones. One thing led to another, and I crossed paths with Tom Clover, who had also been looking for Jones for his own reasons that I was yet to know. We eventually found Jones, and when we did, he had taken a young teenage girl. He ended up killing the girl, and Clover lost it. I captured Jones once again, but when I brought him back, Tom murdered him and then killed himself.
So you cleaned up after him since you weren't supposed to be there in the first place?
Elliot Jr. says.
Yes, son. I did.
So if Jones or Knox or whoever is now dead, then it must be a copycat killer in Greenland now.
I don't believe it is.
Elliot Jr. looks at his father with a completely dumbfounded expression on his face.
The information about the letters and how he signed them was never released to the press, so it has to be someone that knew him. Start with his ex-cellmate, Kenneth Turnbow. If it's not him, I'm sure you can get enough information out of him at least to point you in the right direction.
Thanks, Dad. And don't worry. This whole conversation will stay between you and me.
Elliot Sr. nods his head.
Looks like I'm headed to Minnesota,
Elliot Jr. says as he reaches for the case files. Elliot grabs his son's hand and says,
Please be careful. Whatever you do, don't underestimate the killer. Jones was the smartest person I've ever met. No matter how hard I tried, he was always one step ahead of me. I'm sure whoever he chose to continue his plan will be just as tricky as that son of a bitch was.
I've got this, Dad. Just trust me. I'll make you proud.
Son, I've always been proud of you,
Elliot says, as his eyes fill with tears once again. Elliot Jr. hugs his father before leaving the room. Elliot Jr. returns to Director Bell's office.
Did you talk to your father?
The agent asks.
I did.
What did he have to say about it?
Not too much. He really didn't want to talk about it.
I see,
Director Bell replies. He did tell me that Alfred Knox is the man that killed my mother.
Yes, he is. Which brings me to my next question. Do you still want the case?
Yes, sir, I do.
All right. You and Telly will be heading out first thing in the morning. Have Telly come to my office.
Elliot Jr. shakes his head in agreement as he exits the office.
You wanted to see me, sir?
Telly says as he enters the office.
Yes, come in and shut the door. Special Agent Roberts just landed a serial murder case out of Minnesota. I need you to go with him on this one.
All right, can I ask why?
The case has a lot of ties to his family. The main suspect is the man responsible for his mother's death.
Oh, damn. I see your concern, sir.
Just keep an eye on him. Make sure the case doesn't get personal, and the minute it does, you call me. Is that understood?
Yes, sir. You have my word.
All right. We'll get with Roberts. You guys will be leaving in the morning at 6 a.m.
The following morning, Elliot Jr. awaits Special Agent John Talley in the airport lobby. Shortly after 6:30 in the morning, Talley finally arrives.
Cutting it close, Talley, Elliot Jr. says.
You're worse than my wife. The plane doesn't even start boarding until 7:30.
Yeah,
Elliot Jr. replies. After waiting in the airport lobby for nearly an hour, the plane is finally ready for boarding. Almost an hour later, the plane lands in Minnesota, where the FBI has a typical black SUV waiting for the two agents. After finding the SUV in the airport parking garage, the two men start their hour drive to Greenland, Minnesota. As they approach the small, secluded town, Elliot Jr. notices a welcome sign that reads, Welcome to Greenland, Minnesota. Best kept secret. Elliot Jr. can't help but wonder if that's a good or a bad thing. As they park the black SUV in front of the police department, they are greeted by a young local detective.
Hello, I'm Detective James Hill. We heard that you guys were coming,
Detective Hill says as he reaches out for a handshake. Elliot Jr. denies the gesture and simply replies, Detective Hill, we have work to do. Show us to the chief's office, please. After a brief meeting with the chief, Elliot Jr. is now ready for a conference with all of the local officers.
My name is Special Agent Elliot Roberts, and this is Special Agent John Talley. I called this meeting for one reason and one reason only. We're here because someone couldn't do their jobs. You have someone being murdered once a week, which appears to be by the same person. That classifies this as a serial killer, which then draws the attention of the FBI.
So this is officially an FBI case, therefore we will appreciate any information that any of you have. At the same time, we would also appreciate it if you stay out of our way and let us do our jobs. If you happen to come across any new leads or have any questions, go directly to your chief and he will approach us. Thank you for your time and have a great day. A few moments later, only two people remain in the room. Special agents Elliot Roberts and John Telly. Way to win over the locals, Roberts. We're not here to make friends, Telly. We are here because these hillbilly hicks couldn't do their jobs. Just because they haven't found the killer doesn't mean that they won't be useful. If they haven't found the killer in a month, what makes you think that just because we swoop in to save the day that all of a sudden some of them will become useful? I don't know, Roberts. All I'm saying is, don't burn your bridges before you even cross them. Are we done yet, Telly? Because if it's okay with you, I would like to get to work now. I'll go pull the files, Telly replies. Thank you. They spend the next several hours comparing new files to old ones. What are we looking for? Telly asks out of frustration. If we knew what we were looking for, this case would already be solved. Just keep looking until something pops out at you. I'll be back. I need some coffee, Telly replies. Elliot Jr. waves his hand, as if he were granting Telly permission. Instead of getting coffee, Telly steps outside to make a phone call. He calls Director Bell.
Just checking in, sir. How's everything going so far?
I'm not sure yet. Roberts, well, to put it simple, he's being a jerk to the locals. He's stepping on a lot of toes down here, sir.
Just keep me posted and let him take the lead for now, but call me immediately if things get out of control.
Yes, sir, Telly says before hanging up the phone.
Where's your coffee? Elliot Jr. says as Telly walks back into the conference room.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't find any, Telly quickly replies.
Well, it's getting late. You should check into your hotel. I'll catch up with you in the morning, Elliot Jr. suggests.
All right, sounds good. I'll see you in the morning, then.
Elliot Jr. digs through the paperwork for a few more hours and then heads to the hotel as well.
Chapter 21. Elliot Jr. opens the door of his hotel room to be greeted by the warmth of the fresh morning sun radiating against his face.
It's a beautiful morning, he says to himself as he goes into a big, long stretch.
The first stretch of the day is always the best, and it always leads to a long, drawn-out yawn. Who needs Folgers with mornings like these? He mumbles under his breath. He then slowly heads down the walkway, which is adjacent to the parking lot, when suddenly he sees someone trying to break into his SUV. All he can see is the figure of a large person with a hood over their head. Whoever it is has their back turned towards Elliot Jr.
What the hell are you doing?
Elliot Jr. shouts.
Mind your business!
The person shouts back. It's definitely a man's voice, but it's a voice that Elliot Jr. has never heard before.
I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts with the FBI, and that's my SUV you're trying to break into.
Suddenly, the man takes off in a dead sprint, headed straight for the woods on the other side of the parking lot. Elliot Jr. is frozen in awe for a split second. He was surprised at how quickly the large man could move. It's as if he floated on the wind with his feet never touching the ground. He shakes it off and begins pursuing the suspect. Elliot Jr. has never seen anyone run so fast. The man is already in the woods by the time he makes it to the SUV. But if he got any good trait from his father, it's his will to never give up. So he searches deep inside of himself, and with every huff and puff, his feet begin to glide faster and faster across the pavement. When he approaches the woods, he reaches for a service weapon, but it's not there. He left it on the nightstand next to his bed.
Ha ha ha! Catch me if you can, boy!
The man's irritating voice echoes through the woods.
Motherfucker!
Elliot Jr. says to himself as he pushes through the thick brush of the forest.
Stop running and face me like a man, you fucking coward!
Elliot Jr. shouts. His voice echoes through the woods as well. Suddenly, he sees the man standing in the shadow of a large oak tree.
Well, here I am,
the man says, as if he were teasing Elliot Jr.
Who are you, and what do you want with me?
Oh, I think you know the answer to that,
the man says, as he steps out of the shadows. Elliot Jr.'s heart skips a beat, just from the look of the man's face. Half of his face seems to be melted completely away, while the other half he recognizes from somewhere.
That's it. It's Alfred Knox,
he thinks to himself.
Alfred Knox?
Elliot Jr. asks.
Alive and in the flesh,
the man replies, as he scratches at the melted half of his face. What's left of it anyway?
What do you want with me, Knox?
Temper, temper, just like your father. First things first, I prefer to be called Jones. And what should I call you?
Well, Jones, you can call me Agent Roberts.
I don't like the sound of that. I think I'll just call you EJ,
Jones replies with that damn crooked grin. At least this time, he only has half of his face, so there's a legitimate reason for it.
Now tell me what you want with me,
Elliot Jr. replies. Jones opens his coat and pulls out a .50 caliber sniper rifle. As quickly as he opens his coat, he aims and pulls the trigger. It's a perfect shot. The bullet penetrates Elliot Jr.'s right eye and explodes out of the back of his head, spreading pieces of his brain around the forest. His body lifelessly stands for what seems to be minutes, but in reality was only fractions of a second. Then his body collapses and falls hard to the ground.
What the fuck?
Elliot Sr. says as he wakes himself up after falling out of his bed. After that horrible, vivid dream, he calls Elliot Jr.
Hey, Dad, what's up?
Elliot Jr. says as he answers the phone.
Son, I need to meet you somewhere. Don't ask questions. Just do it. I have a lead on your case.
All right. Where do you want me to meet you?
Green Forest, Maine.
Elliot Sr. replies.
Green Forest, Maine? What in the hell is there?
No questions, son. Just do it, please.
All right. Fine. When?
As quickly as possible.
Okay. I'm on my way.
Elliot Jr. replies. They hang up the phone and Elliot Jr. tells Tally about his father's phone call. The two men then fly to Maine. Once in Green Forest, Elliot Jr. calls his father.
All right, we're here. Where are you?
He asks.
I'm at the gas station.
Which one?
The only one in town. You can't miss it.
Elliot Sr. replies. Elliot Jr. and Tally find the gas station and meet up with Elliot Sr.
What are you doing here, Dad?
Elliot Jr. asks.
Follow me and I'll show you.
The two men do as he asks and follow him to the outskirts of town, down a long dirt road, which eventually leads them to a house in the middle of the woods. The house looks to have been abandoned for years.
Where are we, and whose house is this?
Elliot Jr. asks.
Will you give us a minute alone?
Elliot Sr. asks Tally.
Yeah, sure.
Tally replies. Now that they're alone, Elliot can talk to his son freely.
So what's going on, Dad?
This was Jones' place, where Tom killed him. I burned and buried their bodies just over there,
Elliot Sr. says as he points at a patch of woods.
So what exactly are we doing here?
I had a dream last night that Jones wasn't really dead, so I wanted to dig up his body to be sure.
Elliot Jr. grabs his hair and begins to shake his head.
You mean to tell me that you brought me out here because of a fucking dream?
Son, I've never asked you for anything, but I'm asking you right now to just trust me.
All right, show me where.
Elliot Jr. dreadfully agrees. Meanwhile, back at the car, Tally is making a phone call.
This is Director Bell.
Hey, sir, it's Tally.
What have you got?
Agent Bell asks. Agent Roberts' father called and had us meet him in Green Forest, Maine.
For what?
I don't know, sir. He asked for a minute alone with his son.
Well, damn it. Get closer and find out what the hell is going on down there. Call me back as soon as you know something.
Yes, sir,
Tally says as he hangs up the phone. Tally then stealthily approaches the Roberts in the dark. Tally is now close enough to hear what is being said.
So how do you expect me to take them up without a shovel? Elliot Jr. asks.
We don't need to take them up. I just need to make sure that the grave hasn't been disturbed.
All right, fine. Lead the way,
Elliot Jr. says as he throws his hands up in the air. Elliot Sr. leads his son about a half mile into the thick wooded area while Tally quietly follows close behind.
This is it. This is the spot,
Elliot Sr. says.
Are you sure?
I buried their bodies right here.
Tally has heard enough. He steps out of the dark cover of the woods with gun in hand.
Put your hands up. You're under arrest.
Tally, what the hell are you doing?
Elliot Jr. says.
I'm doing what you should be doing, arresting a murderer.
Put your damn gun down. I didn't murder anyone,
Elliot Sr. proclaims.
Then would you like to explain to me who's buried here? I heard everything.
Out of nowhere, a gunshot echoes through the thin air of the night. Blood splatters as the bullet exits Tally's head. His cold, soulless body collapses hard to the ground. Elliot Jr. glances at his father, naturally thinking he took the shot, but his hands are empty, which can only mean one thing. They are not alone in these woods.
No one will be getting arrested tonight. That would just take all the fun out of the entire plan,
a voice from the darkness says.
Who's there?
Elliot Jr. asks as he draws his weapon.
The name's another killer, but you may know me better as AK.
Did you follow us here from Greenland?
Elliot Jr. shouts.
Shut up, boy. I'm asking the questions. It's been a long time, Special Agent Elliot Roberts.
Do I know you?
Elliot Sr. says.
Nobody really knows the true me, but yes, we've met a time or two.
So what now?
Elliot Sr. asks.
Now the fun begins. Both of you throw your weapons on the ground.
Elliot Sr. and Elliot Jr. do as they're told.
Very good. Now take out your cell phones and crush them to pieces.
Just do it, son.
Elliot Sr. whispers. Again, both men do as they're told.
All right, now what?
Elliot Sr. asks.
Now you're going to die, Special Agent Elliot Roberts. I've been listening to you, and you've confirmed what I've already known for years.
And what's that?
Elliot Sr. asks.
That you killed the only father I've ever known, right here on his own property.
Then the eerie sound of a gunshot echoes through the woods once again. The bullet pierces Elliot Sr. in the chest. He's knocked backwards from the blast. He screams in agonizing pain as the blood leaks from his chest.
It's decision time for you, young Roberts. Come after me or save your father,
the shooter says as he escapes through the woods.
Go,
Elliot Sr. manages to mumble.
I'm not leaving you, Dad.
Son, this is your time. All that's left of me now is a dwindling flame of fire that once was.
No, Dad, you hold on. It's not time for you to go yet,
Elliot Jr. says as he pushes his hands against his father's chest, trying to stop the bleeding.
I know who the killer is, son.
Who is it?
It's...
Elliot Sr. starts to say before losing consciousness.
No, Dad. Damn it, no!
Elliot Jr. screams as tears begin to flow from his eyes.
Tell me that. Who is it?
He says as he shakes his father's now lifeless body. Special Agent Elliot Roberts Sr. is dead, and his son is the only fire he has left burning. His last hope. His last remaining embers. Chapter 22. Elliot Jr. begins to slip into shock. Memories of his father are flowing through his mind like a river in a valley. He can feel himself slipping deeper and deeper inside of his own mind. But there's nothing he can do about it. It's not like he can just turn his memories off and on like a water faucet. He is quickly drifting into a deep, coma-like state of depression. And then a miracle happens. The visions of his memories are no longer blinding his eyes. Suddenly he can see more clearly than he ever could before.
Telly's phone,
he thinks to himself. Elliot Jr. calls the local authorities, and within an hour, a massive manhunt is underway. It doesn't take long for the news in a small town to spread like wildfire. In only a few hours, the news that a serial killer is on the run in the area has circulated through all of the neighboring counties. A total of 5 counties have now joined in on the manhunt. The entire area is crawling with cops, volunteers, and 15 highly trained bloodhounds. The area is locked down better than Fort Knox. There is no way that anyone could slip through the giant net cast upon the entire region. Sounds of people chattering and hundreds of footsteps rustling in the dark now pollute the cold, quiet night. It seems as if all 15 dogs are going crazy, barking and howling with their handlers shouting,
"Over here! We have something!"
Elliot Jr. doesn't know which way to go first. His father and partner were just murdered, and the eerie sounds fill the air. He truly feels as if he is in a dream and expects to wake up at any moment. He approaches one of the handlers and his bloodhound. The dog is yapping and pawing at the ground beneath him.
I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it sure has his attention,
the handler says.
Seems like there's a lot of that going on tonight,
Elliot Jr. replies.
Get someone over here. Let's dig this up,
the handler shouts. A few seconds later, one of the many volunteers comes rushing over with shovels in hand.
I'm ready. Just show me where,
the volunteer says.
The handler shows the man exactly where to dig. Underneath a foot of dirt, they uncover a wool sweater.
Bag it,
Elliot Jr. says to one of the nearby officers before making his way to the next handler. Over the next 2 hours, the 15 dogs along with their handlers and many volunteers uncovered 30-plus t-shirts and sweaters.
Sir, the dogs are just going in circles. If we keep this up, we will be here till the morning,
the local police chief says.
He was smart. He planned all of this. Hell, he was probably out here days ahead of us burying all this shit,
Elliot Jr. replies as he snatches a t-shirt from the chief's hands.
What do you want us to do?
The chief asks, as the sky is lit up by lightning and the crashing sound of thunder rumbles into the treetops.
This man killed 2 federal agents and God knows how many other people. And you have the nerve to ask me what I want? I want you to find the son of a bitch,
Elliot Jr. replies, as the rain starts pouring down.
The dogs can't track in this weather, and even if they could, I think they'd be going in circles all night.
Just keep looking. He's out here somewhere. We can't let him get away.
Look, agent, I respect your authority. But I can't ask my men to have all these people stay out here in these conditions,
the chief replies as he raises his voice to be heard over the thunder and the heavy downpour of rain.
You do what you need to do, but I'm staying,
Elliot Jr. replies as he walks away deeper into the woods.
Agent, I'll stay a few more hours to see if the storm passes, but after that,
Elliot Jr. interrupts the chief.
I know. Thank you, chief.
The storm continues its heavy downpour of rain, and after 2 more hours of chasing their tails, the chief calls off the search. The chief stands in front of Elliot Jr., with the rain dripping off of what looks to be a well-worn 20-year-old cowboy hat, and says,
I'm sorry, but I have to get these people out of here. This area is known for flash floods, and that is an epidemic I don't want on my hands. I hope you understand.
Thanks, Chief, Elliot says, before heading back into the woods. But this time, the chief doesn't stop him. Within an hour, all of the volunteers and the local law enforcement officers have abandoned the search and are now out of the woods. Elliot Jr. uses the periodic lightning strikes which light up the sky to venture further into the dark. His maglite works well, but only in the direction that he aims it. So he welcomes every lightning strike, even if the glow only lasts for a few seconds. With the sound of the endless raindrops crashing into the trees and the occasional clap of thunder, it makes it very difficult to hear any movement outside of his immediate surroundings. But Elliot Jr. pushes on. After all, this person, this murderer, just snatched a life away from his father right in front of his eyes. He feels like he owes it to his father to capture the killer. So even if he wanted to, there's no way he could just give up now. Elliot Jr. keeps pushing deeper and deeper into the woods. For a split second he pauses as if he hears someone trampling the woods nearby. He shines his flashlight into the pitch dark night. He scans the area with his light, but there's no one to be seen. Just as he is considering the fact that it must have been a stray animal, a large array of lightning strikes light up the sky. For that very brief moment in time, when the sky is bright enough to light the forest below, Elliot Jr. sees him.
The person that killed his father is a mere 50 feet away with a high-powered sniper rifle pointed in his direction. Elliot Jr. doesn't know if it's the lightning striking again, or if it's that old saying that your life flashes before your eyes. Whichever the case may be, there was a loud bang, and then a bright flash followed by complete darkness. As Elliot stands motionless, waiting for his eyes to adapt to the darkness, he hears the killer's voice.
I thought that this should be a little more even, and since I don't have a flashlight, I didn't think you should either. Now let the games begin, so catch me if you can.
Suddenly it dawns on Elliot Jr. The loud bang wasn't thunder at all, and the flash wasn't lightning, nor was it light flashing before his eyes. In fact, the bang was a gunshot, and the flash was from the barrel. The speeding bullet was aimed directly at his flashlight. This guy is good. Too damn good. He could have easily taken me out. Elliot Jr. thinks to himself before responding.
Don't fucking move! Stay where you are!
He shouts. Elliot Jr. can hear footsteps running through the woods, trailed by a daunting laugh.
You'll never catch me!
The killer taunts as he makes his getaway. There's no rhyme or reason for what Elliot Jr. does next. Completely blinded by the night, in unfamiliar terrain, he takes off at a dead sprint in search of the killer. It's obvious that the killer knows the territory very well. Within a matter of minutes, Elliot Jr. has lost all signs of him. But his pride won't let him give up, so he dashes through the woods, getting scraped by branch after branch. Although the rain is now slowed, it's still coming down fairly heavy. After 30 minutes of running through the woods, Elliot Jr. comes to a clearing. It looks to be a creek or a small river crossing about 30 feet wide. Whatever it is, he's not stopping. Elliot Jr. runs directly into the water. Surprisingly, the current isn't strong, nor is the water very deep. He shuffles across the waist-deep water. The first 20 feet go smoothly, and then suddenly he can't move. He begins to struggle, flailing his arms in panic. His right foot is caught on something beneath the water. Elliot Jr. takes a deep breath and goes under in hopes of freeing himself. After the fifth attempt, Elliot Jr. now realizes he has a more dangerous problem. The water that only minutes ago was waist-deep has now risen to his chest. As the water quickly rises to his chin, Elliot Jr. is now in full panic mode. He grabs his leg and tugs with all the strength he has, but there's no use. His foot is pinned tightly between two boulders. Just before the water covers his head completely, Elliot Jr. takes one last breath.
Is this the very last breath I will ever take? Will they ever find the killer?
These are some of the thoughts going through Elliot Jr.'s mind just before it all goes black and he loses consciousness. His eyelids blink slowly, open and close, open and close. Elliot Jr. then manages to keep his eyes open. Although his vision is blurred, he can tell that there's someone standing up with him.
Looks like you're gonna make it,
he hears the blurred image of the person say.
What? What happened?
He replies, as he rubs his fist against his eyes.
You were drowning in the creek. You're damn lucky I came by when I did.
The killer, Elliot thinks to himself.
Did you see anyone else nearby?
Nope, just you.
As Elliot begins to regain his vision, he notices the blur is beginning to come into focus. He sees that it's a young man, roughly the same age as himself.
So what are you doing out here? Elliot asks.
I have a deer stand not too far from here. I always come to check in on it when the weather gets like this. Luckily for you, I always follow the creek to my stand.
Thank you,
Elliot Jr. says as he sits up.
Take it easy. Come on, let me help you up,
the man says as he extends his hand out. Elliot Jr. grabs his hand and allows the man to help him stand up.
Elliot Jr. feels as if he were just knocked out on the first round of a heavyweight fight, jello legs and slightly confused. My truck's right down the road. We need to get you into some dry clothes, the man says, as he points down a narrow path. Elliot Jr. just nods. The man throws Elliot Jr.'s arm over his shoulder and the two men slowly walk down the path. They finally arrive at the man's old, beaten-up truck. After helping Elliot Jr. into the passenger side of the vehicle, the man gets into the driver's seat and begins driving down the narrow dirt road.
So what were you doing in the creek?
I was trying to cross it and then my foot got wedged.
Why were you trying to cross it in this weather? Everyone knows this area is bad for flash floods.
Official FBI business, Elliot Jr. replies as he lifts his coat and shows the man his credentials.
Oh, I see. Well, where can I take you?
The man replies. The police station, please.
Will the sheriff's department do? We don't really have a police station,
the man replies with a smile on his face. That will be fine.
My name is Robert Turner, by the way, but everyone calls me Bob.
Thanks, Bob. I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts.
After a 30-minute drive into town, they arrive at the sheriff's department.
Thanks, Bob, Elliot Jr. says as he begins to exit the truck.
Hold on a second. Let me help you,
Bob says as he opens the driver's door.
I'm fine. You've done enough.
Well, at least let me walk you in and make sure you get inside all right.
Do I really have a choice?
Elliot Jr. replies with a slight smile. Even Elliot Jr. is surprised at himself. He's not really the joking around and making friends type of guy. But there's just something about Bob that truly makes him easy to like. Or maybe it's the fact that he just saved his life. But whatever it is, Elliot Jr. is glad to have met him. After helping Elliot Jr. to the door, as quickly as he came, Bob was gone. Elliot Jr. still isn't sure if it was fate, pure luck, or some bizarre coincidence that put Bob near the creek at that exact moment. After taking a warm shower and changing into some dry clothes at the sheriff's department, Elliot Jr. sits down for a chat with the sheriff.
Agent Roberts, I feel terrible that I left you out there all alone.
Elliot Jr. shakes his head and replies,
You shouldn't feel bad. It was my fault and mine alone.
So what happened?
The sheriff asks.
I was chasing the killer and tried to cross the creek when I got stuck. Then the water began to rise. That's all I remember until I woke up and saw Bob.
Bob Turner?
Yes, do you know him?
Elliot replies.
He's a fine young man. He's lived in the area for 3, maybe 5 years.
What can you tell me about him? Elliot Jr. asks.
Not a whole lot. He pretty much stays to himself. Doesn't surprise me, though, that he's the one that found you.
Oh, and why is that?
He's always out there checking on his deer stands. I do know one thing about the kid. He's an excellent deer hunter.
Well, I'm glad he was there when he was. Thanks for the shower and the clothes. I need to call my boss now. Do you mind if I use your phone?
Elliot Jr. asks.
No, not at all, the sheriff replies, as he waves his hand at the phone as if he is saying, help yourself. Elliot Jr. begins dialing the numbers and then gives the sheriff a look.
I guess I need to go check on the boys,
the sheriff says, realizing the point of the look Elliot gave him just before heading out of the room. Elliot Jr. calls Director Bell and briefs him on the events that have taken place tonight. By the next morning, the small quiet town in the corner of Maine is littered with the top FBI agents from all over the country. After leaving the sheriff's department the night before, Elliot Jr. checked into the local hotel. Bang, bang, bang. The sound of someone knocking on the door echoes throughout the hotel room. Elliot Jr. rolls over and looks at the clock on the nightstand.
It's 5:30 a.m. Who the hell?
Elliot Jr. thinks to himself as he crawls out of bed. He didn't get very much sleep over the night, but the little bit that he did, he was enjoying. He swings the door open, standing there with nothing on but his boxers.
What?
He shouts as the door opens.
You need to get dressed. We have work to do, Agent Roberts.
Elliot Jr. was shocked to see Director Bell on the other side of his door.
I was just about to get in the shower,
Elliot Jr. replies. Director Bell nods and says,
All right, meet me at the sheriff's department when you're done.
He then hands Elliot Jr. a set of keys.
I have a car parked in front for you.
Elliot Jr. quickly showers and then puts on his prototypical black suit and tie. After getting dressed, he gets in the car and makes his way to the sheriff's department.
If Bell is here, it can't be good,
he thinks to himself. As he nears the sheriff's department, he braces himself for the ass-chewing he is about to receive. Now in the building, Elliot Jr. searches for Director Bell. He spots a young deputy in the hallway.
Excuse me, do you know where?
Elliot Jr. begins to say before the deputy interrupts.
They're all in the conference room,
he says as he points down the hallway.
Thanks.
Yeah,
the deputy replies in more of a gargling mumble than an actual voice. Elliot Jr. is surprised to see that the conference room is jam-packed with agents.
Roberts, get in here,
Director Bell says, as he does a waving gesture with his hand. Elliot Jr. makes his way through the crowd of agents to enter the room.
All right, now that everyone's here, let's get started. I'm sure by now all of you know why you're here, but it's my job to go over it anyway. Last night we lost two members of our family and nearly lost a third one. Special Agent John Talley and the finest agent I've ever known, Agent Elliot Roberts Sr. Both men were gunned down and murdered last night,
says Director Bell. Some of the agents in the room shed a few tears. Many just shake their heads and look at the floor, but not one of them says a word.
The third agent on the scene nearly lost his life trying to apprehend the suspect. Let's give Agent Elliot Roberts Jr. a round of applause for his efforts, willpower, and sheer determination.
The hair all over Elliot Jr.'s body stands up and his eyes begin to fill with tears as the once silent agents give him an unbelievable welcome and ovation.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Elliot Jr. says as he waves his hands in the air as though to silence the room.
This means a lot to me, but the reason you're here is because I failed at my job. I was unable to capture the man responsible for the death of these two agents. This killer is extremely intelligent and seems to be well-trained. I would be willing to bet that he has some kind of military background.
Is this the Saw killer that we were looking for?
One of the other agents in the room asks.
No, he's not. But right before he shot my father, he told us he knows Alfred Knox, a.k.a. Harry Jones.
So he has a military background and he's connected to Knox. That's a great starting point,
the other agent replies. Elliot Jr. nods his head and agrees with the other agent. After the meeting, Elliot Jr. and Director Jerry Bell have a private sit-down.
How are you holding up?
Director Bell asks.
I'm fine. I was just a little dizzy from passing out. That's great to hear, but I mean emotionally. This is still your case. I just need to make sure that you're mentally capable of handling it.
I'm good, really. I just want to catch this bastard,
Elliot Jr. replies as he looks Director Bell directly in the eyes.
All right, well then it's still your lead. Now let's get out there and find him before he causes any more damage.
Later that afternoon, Elliot Jr. replays the events from the night before over and over again in his mind. Out of everything that happened that night, there's only one thing that stands out that just doesn't add up. Whether it be just a gut feeling, or the fact that it's just too coincidental that out of all the square miles of wooded area covering this region, Robert Turner just happens to be in the right place at the right time. It doesn't make sense. And usually, during these types of investigations, things that don't add up or make any sense turn out to be key factors in solving the case. So Elliot Jr. decides to run some background information on Turner. During the background check on Robert Turner, Elliot Jr. finds out what very well could be exactly what he needs to break this case wide open. Chapter 23. While searching locally in Maine, Elliot Jr. couldn't find anything on Robert Turner. No property, no cell phones, credit cards, nothing. This strikes Elliot Jr. as very odd, considering the fact that the sheriff told him that Turner has deer stands set up throughout the woods. So whose land is it? Elliot Jr. thinks to himself. He digs deeper and broadens the range of his search. He finds records of a Robert Turner being arrested for battery on a police officer from over 20 years ago. But there are two things that catch Elliot Jr.'s eyes. The first is the name of the officer involved in the battery charge. The second is where it took place. The officer was none other than Jimmy Morstead of the Greenland, Minnesota PD. Elliot Jr. remembers this name from the files on Jones.
That's it. There's no way this is a coincidence, Elliot Jr. says to himself.
After getting clearance from Director Bell, Elliot Jr. and three other agents catch a flight to Greenland. Now that Elliot Jr. and the other agents have arrived in Greenland, Minnesota, Elliot Jr. hands out tasks for the other three agents to do, an act that was mainly meant to keep the agents out of his way. Elliot Jr. thinks that the best place to start would be by talking to Morstead's widow about Robert Turner. He stops at the local police department to get an address for Mrs. Morstead. As he pulls into the driveway, Elliot Jr. sees a woman sitting alone on the porch.
Poor lady. She looks so sad,
Elliot Jr. mumbles under his breath. He gets out of his vehicle and approaches the woman.
Hello, ma'am, I'm...
he begins to say before being interrupted.
Do I know you? You look so familiar,
the woman says.
No, you don't. But are you Mrs. Susan Morstead?
Yes, I am. Can I help you?
I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts with the FBI. You might have known my father.
Of course I remember him. How is he doing?
Do you mind if we go inside and talk? Elliot Jr. asks.
Not at all. Come on in. What's this all about?
Mrs. Morstead asks as they take a seat on the couch. At this moment, Elliot Jr. notices a picture on the coffee table separating the two couches.
How do you know Bob Turner?
Elliot Jr. asks as he picks up the picture. Mrs. Morstead begins to laugh.
I'm sorry. Did I miss something?
Elliot Jr. says.
His name isn't Bob Turner. That's my son, Jimmy Jr.
Out of nowhere, the sound of his father's voice saying his dying words echo through Elliot Jr.'s mind. He keeps replaying it over and over like a broken record.
I know who the killer is. More, more, more.
And then it dawns on him. He was trying to say Morstead, Elliot Jr. thinks to himself. When was the last time you saw your son?
I haven't seen JJ in years. He just disappeared one day, right around the time he turned 18.
How old is he now? Elliot Jr. asks.
He's 24, she replies,
as her sad eyes begin to fill with tears. Elliot Jr. has everything he needs to know. Thank you for your time. I'll be in touch, he says as he stands up from the couch. Do you mind if I borrow this picture? I promise I'll bring it back, he asks.
Go right ahead. I have plenty more,
she replies with a gentle smile. As Elliot Jr. exits the front door, he truly can't believe his eyes, and for a moment he's frozen in shock. It's Jimmy Morstead Jr. getting out of a car at the end of the driveway. As the two make brief eye contact, Morstead frantically jumps back into the vehicle. In just a matter of seconds, Morstead is speeding away. Elliot Jr. sprints to his car. There's no room for hesitation. The next few seconds will be vital if he expects to stay on Morstead's trail. As Elliot Jr. speeds off in pursuit, he calls the local police department.
This is Special Agent Elliot Roberts. I'm in hot pursuit of a suspect considered to be armed and dangerous. I need all available units now,
he shouts into the phone. The well-trained dispatcher manages to stay calm.
All right, sir. What's your location?
She asks.
I'm leaving the Morstead residence.
What's the description of the suspect and vehicle?
Caucasian male, 24 years of age, sandy blonde hair, approximately 5'9", 185 pounds. The vehicle looks to be a late model blue Ford Taurus with dark tinted windows.
Officers are on their way. Do you have a name for the suspect?
The dispatcher asks.
Jimmy Morstead Jr.
There's a brief moment of silence on the line. Although the dispatcher didn't know Morstead Sr. personally, everyone in this small town knows the story of the Saw Killer and how he murdered his own partner.
Officer should be arriving at your location shortly, she replies.
Elliot Jr. hangs up the phone and continues his pursuit. He pushes his car to its limits, topping out at 110 miles per hour. He can see Morstead about a mile ahead, but the gap is closing and closing fast. Moments later, three police cruisers slide into the intersection right behind Morstead. If they were only fractions of a second sooner, the lead car would have taken Morstead out.
You're not getting away this time, you son of a bitch,
Elliot Jr. says to himself. With the other cruisers now involved in the chase, they are able to relay their exact location to even more cruisers over the radio. Now that everyone knows Morstead's exact location, other officers are busy setting out spike strips and roadblocks, blocking any possible escape route. They race down a two-lane highway at speeds in excess of 100 miles an hour. Suddenly, Morstead sees a roadblock ahead. There are four cruisers blocking the narrow highway. Two cruisers stretch across the highway with the other two stacked directly behind him. On the other side of the road lies a shallow embankment leading to a ditch. As he approaches the barricade, Morstead slams on his brakes and banks hard to the left. He loses control of the vehicle and slides nose first down the embankment straight into the ditch below. Seconds later, officers surround the car as smoke pours from the busted radiator.
Don't move!
Several officers shout in unison. With several Berettas aimed directly at Morstead, Elliot Jr. slowly approaches the driver's side of the vehicle. With his service weapon in his right hand, he opens the door with his left.
Get on the ground,
Elliot Jr. says. And surprisingly enough, Morstead doesn't hesitate. He immediately gets out of the car, lies down on the ground, and puts his hands behind his head. Elliot Jr. proceeds to cuff him while digging a hard kneecap directly between Morstead's shoulder blades, of course. Morstead has been sitting in the interrogation room for over an hour when Elliot Jr. finally walks in. Elliot Jr. slams two folders on the table before sitting across from Morstead.
I want a lawyer,
Morstead demands.
I take it you know Harry Jones,
Elliot Jr. says, as he slowly opens one of the folders. Inside the folder, there are case files and detailed photographs of all of Jones' victims.
Did you hear me? I said I want a lawyer,
Morstead repeats. These were all of Jones' victims that we know about, Elliot Jr. says, as he spreads the photographs out. Take a look at this one. It might seem familiar to you, Elliot Jr. says, as he points at a photograph of Jimmy Morstead Sr.
This is bullshit! Jones didn't kill him! He might have pulled the trigger, but it was an accident!
Morstead Jr. replies.
Just like it was an accident that you shot and killed two FBI agents?
I heard something about that, but I didn't have anything to do with it. I do have to admit, though, that I'm glad that one of them is dead.
And which one is that? Elliot Jr. replies.
Your father, the man that was actually responsible for killing mine.
What makes you come to that conclusion? Elliot Jr. asks.
Jones told me all about it. We stayed in close contact over the years until one day he just stopped calling and writing.
What if I could show you a video of Jones confessing to killing your father?
I think that you asking me that only proves that such a video doesn't exist,
Morstead Jr. replies.
Give me a minute. I'll be right back,
Elliot Jr. says as he stands up and exits the room. 30 minutes later, Elliot Jr. returns with an old VCR tape in his hand.
Look what I found laying around,
Elliot Jr. says as he waves the tape in the air. He places the tape in the VCR and pushes play. It's Special Agent Elliot Roberts Sr. questioning Harry Jones in this very same room over 20 years ago. After watching the confession, Morstead Jr. begins to break down. His eyes are filled with tears, and it feels as if there is a lump in his throat.
My whole life, it's all been a lie. Everything Jones taught me or ever told me was just part of his sick game.
It's okay, you didn't know, Elliot Jr. says in a calm, warm, and bracing tone.
I'm so sorry,
Morstead Jr. replies.
What are you sorry for? It wasn't your fault.
I'm sorry that I killed your father and that other agent.
I'm glad that you feel remorse for killing Special Agent Elliot Roberts Sr. and John Talley.
I do, now that I know the truth,
Morstead Jr. replies.
Thanks for your confession. That's all I needed,
Elliot Jr. says as he stands up and makes his way to the door.
Wait, so what now?
Morstead Jr. asks.
Now I hope that you burn in hell after you spend the rest of your pathetic life in prison,
Elliot Jr. replies as he slams the door shut behind him. With a recorded confession of murdering two FBI agents, Jimmy Morstead Jr. didn't stand a chance in court. He was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. Now that Elliot Jr. knows his father's murderer will never walk freely again, he can finally move on with his life and let his father's memory rest in peace. The case of the Saw Killer, the one case his father could never solve, is finally closed. This has been Hunt or Be Hunted, Remaining Embers by C.H. Bordelon. Narrated by Tommy Carrera. Copyright 2014. Production copyright 2015 by Barn & Coolboard Publishing. Disclaimer. All characters, events, places, and names used in this book are fictional. They have been fabricated from the imagination of the author. It is completely a coincidence if any place, name, or event in this book happened to be real. From the author. Thanks for listening to the Hunt or Be Hunted series. I truly hope that you have enjoyed the ride as much as we have in creating it for your listening pleasure. This has truly been a humbling experience. Working with Mr. Carrera was absolutely amazing. To have the opportunity to actually hear the characters coming to life, wow. So for myself, thank you for all your hard work, Tommy. You're welcome, Chris. If you have enjoyed this series, you may be interested in Cop Games by C.H. Bordelon, available for download today.